This is Boston Public Radio. We're on tape today, replaying some of our favorite recent conversations. We kick things off with veteran NPR reporter Corey Flintoff. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Last September, while all of us were obsessing with the 2016 presidential election, NPR's Corey Flintoff was in Moscow reporting on their parliamentary races. Now that we're learning something new each day about the connections Russia has with Trump's presidential campaign, who better to talk about the interaction of these two nations? Corey Flintoff recently retired. Great loss, I should say. Maybe not for him, but for us, was a radio journalist for nearly 40 years. Covered the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Ukraine, the earthquake in Haiti, the revolution in Egypt, the revolution and civil war in Libya. He was NPR's correspondent in Moscow for 4 years, reporting on the growing authoritarianism of Vladimir Putin. Corey, it's a pleasure to meet you after all these years. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming. And we want to get to that authoritarianism that's increasing over there with Putin in a second. But I did want to ask you about this metro bombing in St. Petersburg. What we know about the young man involved, what we know about everything.
Well, you know, I mean, it's more a question of not so much about what we know as what we're prepared to believe. You know, I mean, the Russian government, the Kremlin, has been known to use these things as provocations. And in fact, there's a famous case before Putin's first election as president of a series of really devastating apartment bombings in Russia, you know, where civilians were killed. And these have later been alleged to have been a provocation on the part of Putin's people that helped him get elected.
How?
Well,
let
me be clear. When you say a provocation, do you mean something that happens that he chooses to use as a provocation, or something that may be inspired by somebody in his ranks?
Let's say something committed by somebody in his
really?
Ranks.
Really?
Yes.
And that's possible in
the
St. Petersburg situation?
David Sater has written a really good book about this.
Okay, hold on for a second. Why would you blow up civilians in apartments to help you get and retain power?
To create a narrative that there was a threat of constant threat of Islamic terrorism from Chechnya.
Okay.
And that's when Putin, after being elected, launched the Second Chechen War, this incredibly brutal war that completely subjugated Chechnya.
So what could be a possible motive for this latest attack, which is supposedly related to ISIS?
Consolidate power? More
and
more?
Yes, as you know, we just saw these enormous, surprising protests in more than 100 Russian cities last month against protests against corruption. You know, brought out something like 20,000 people in Moscow alone.
Massive.
Yeah. So this has not happened since I first got to Russia, which was in 2012. That was something that was, you know, later brutally suppressed by the Kremlin. But now it's popped up again.
My understanding is the leader of the protest, though, who's indicated some interest in running for president, is barred. Is he not?
Yes,
because he has a criminal record.
Legally, he cannot run for president because of a series of criminal charges and criminal trials that were brought against him. They were, at the very least, unfair trials. You know, if you listen to various justice NGOs, they were not only unfair, they were just ludicrous.
Okay, before we get to the protest, which I found fascinating, let's just give the Cliff Notes version of Vladimir Putin. I mean, you were over there. Who is he?
Well, you know, he is a guy of whom so much has been written and of whom so little is known. You know, in my whole time there, I saw him many times in action. You know, he's a charismatic guy. Mm-hmm. One of the most appealing things about him is his absolute comfort in power. You know, he's always very relaxed, you know, and, you know, he's a physically rather small man who manages to fill a great deal of space whenever he comes into a room, you know. He's that kind of
guy. How small, like 5'8"?
Yeah, no, we're more like 5'6", I think.
Really?
Yeah.
That's shorter than I am.
Yeah, this is a guy who wears lifts in his shoes. It's been demonstrated, you know, by people who show photographs of him, you know. Yeah. Anyway, this is, you know, a man who has a great deal of personal charisma. And he's grown into the job. When I first got there, a lot of Kremlin analysts spent a great deal of time talking about the power structure in the Kremlin and who was who. And they drew charts and graphs with people's photographs on them to show the people of power on one side and the economic liberals on the other. And Putin was seen as this kind of mediator, like the guy who maintained his power by balancing the forces in his power group. Well, that's no longer the case because his side essentially won, and he's moved in the 4 years that I was there from being this mediator to a one-man autocrat.
Okay.
So when you see the which perfect segue back to the protests we talked about a minute ago is so protest the numbers of protesters and the breadth of the protests are expanding, but this is against the backdrop of we read whether you're in Russia or elsewhere in the world and for lack of a better expression plotting or even speaking against Putin. You're likely to have a fairly short shelf life, literally.
Yeah.
So what's a reasonable expectation in the finite future of what protests lead to?
Well, my expectation – well, this takes us back to the St. Petersburg bombing. Whether or not – whether that was a lone wolf bombing, you know, by some mentally disturbed individual, the kind of things that we see in this country, or whether that was a provocation – organized by one of the security services, it is going to give the government an excuse to crack down on opposition on the grounds that it's somehow related to terrorism.
Okay.
And
isn't there a third? I mean, the third option that I had heard, Corey, was that, and this is what I assumed it was, but I'm glad you're here to disabuse me of it, is that these were people who were really upset with Putin's support for Assad. And it was a reaction. Is that a possible?
Absolutely a possibility. Yeah.
We just don't know.
Right. Now, the guy who's been fingered as the suicide bomber is a Central Asian man from Kyrgyzstan.
And, right.
We don't know that, you know, that's not a place that's been associated with Islamic terrorism. It's not a place that has sent fighters in any numbers to places like Syria. You know, those people are coming from places like Chechnya and so forth.
Yeah. How hard is it to report from Moscow, from Russia?
Well, it's really difficult to report and interview officials from the government. You know, they pay very little attention to foreign reporters. They don't feel that they need to. In fact, it's almost a liability for a government minister, say, to talk to a foreign reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Why should I? So that's difficult. That means that a great deal of the work you do, it's about politics and government. You have to do with people from think tanks and universities and so forth.
How hard is that? I don't mean hard to report, but psychologically, when you know that you're one degree away or maybe more degrees away of where you would go if you were virtually anywhere else in the world.
And under surveillance.
How hard is it, or exactly, too. How hard is it to deal with that?
Yeah, it is hard. I mean, reporters do not like to be speculative. Reporters do not like to report at second and third hand, you know. And that's something that's always difficult to do. And it is psychologically difficult, and it wears you down.
But in terms of the surveillance, did you feel that you were – what did you think was the degree of surveillance if there were detectable surveillance when you were there?
You know, Russians always say among themselves that you should always assume that the government is listening to you. The question is – Are they bothering? They have the capacity to listen to you, but are they bothering to do it? And I didn't feel that they bothered very much to
okay.
Watch
so
me.
You would so you could go out to a coffee shop and have a frank discussion or an outdoor cafe or something. You weren't you were not worried about that kind of thing.
Exactly, I wasn't worried about that. Although shortly things got worse as time went on. And for instance, shortly before I left, I did a trip to Kaliningrad, you know, which is a military exclave. You know, on the Baltic Sea, that where Russia has been moving a great deal of weaponry and manpower to, a place from which you can reach, you know, a Russian missile could reach Germany, for instance. So it's a place that's very sensitive, and my colleague and I were definitely followed when we were there, followed around by a pair of presumably...
Now, can you FFB turn around people? And kind of give them a salute or a wave? Or
yes.
You do.
You do.
Do they wave back?
Of fact, You know, Kaliningrad is one of these places. It's a lovely city with a lot of canals and bridges.
Yeah.
And very easy to get lost in. And so my colleague and I took a wrong turn, crossed a bridge, realized that we were wrong, turned around, and there's our two guys standing there, you know, I mean, obviously embarrassed, you know, they
what do you
out.
Say? Can you give us directions? Is that what you
You know, they kind of, they won't talk to you.
No, I understand.
But they said they whipped out their cell phones and they were suddenly very, very busy. You know?
Corey Flint, we're talking to Corey Flintoff, who you know if you've listened to radio in the last several decades, most recently in Moscow prior to retirement. I'm guessing, in light of your response to the St. Petersburg thing and saying it's possible provocation, when you heard, I think it was James Clapper testifying in front of Congress that 17 intelligence agencies, I think it was 17, agreed that the Russians had attempted to affect the outcome of this election. Obviously, we don't know whether there was any collusion with Trump people or not yet. Was that a big yawn for you? Was that like, so tell me something I didn't know before?
It wasn't a big yawn, but it surprised me a little bit to think that it might have been as organized as it apparently
was. Why do you say
that? Well, because, you know, before I left, we were talking about the Russian reaction to the American election. Most Russian analysts that I talked to, for instance, didn't think that Trump had a chance, and they didn't think that the Kremlin was very invested in seeing Trump elected.
But they wanted to bruise Hillary Clinton, even if she ended up being president. She wanted to tarnish her image
exactly.
as best they could.
And they were certainly doing that with overt propaganda, both inside Russia and outside. And in fact, last summer, if you'd spent a lot of time listening to Russian media, you would have felt that Russia and the United States were on the verge of war. Mm. I mean, it was that serious. And, you know, Russian newspapers were producing headlines like, if Hillary wins, she will surround Russia with nuclear missiles. That
Wow.
Absolutely. Absolutely frightening. And so, you know, I can see that there was obviously a feeling on the part of the Kremlin that, you know, something had to be done to discredit this woman and make sure that kind of narrative was being played in the West as well. And it was played by, you know, their two international propaganda sources, RT and Sputnik. You know, they did a great deal.
You think they're the ones that came up with the idea that Hillary Clinton had 39,000 guillotines that she was going to use against her enemies if she won? Or is that the Macedonian teenagers?
I think that's a teenager story. But
okay. Well, you know, get back to this protest thing for a minute then, with the increasing authoritarianism you're talking about. It's pretty courageous to be among those 20,000, even if it is 20,000, to take to the streets in Russia. What's the calculation there before you run out with your protest sign?
Well, it is absolutely. And these last protests were a big change because I got a message from a friend of mine who went on, you know, there was a memorial march for Boris Nemtsov, the leader who was shot down within sight of the Kremlin 2 years ago. And so there was a memorial march for him. And a friend of mine who's a middle-aged woman, Russian woman, wrote to me and said, you know, it was disappointing because it was smaller than the year before. And I feel that I know everybody at these protests because I recognize them every time. And the worst thing was that there were no young people. So just a month or so later, there's this gigantic protest, and it's full of young people, teenagers.
Why is that?
Well, that's the question. You know, apparently it wasn't, you know, the issue of political opposition that got these people into the streets. It was the issue of corruption. You know, there was a documentary that got a lot of hits on the Russian internet. It was produced by Alexei Navalny,
the guy who can't run
for president.
He's the one he got the 15-day prison sentence.
Exactly.
Which precludes him from the presidency. You know, we only have a minute or two left, Corey Flintoff. No one has adequately explained to me, other than maybe economic concerns, the bromance between, at least up until now, between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Can you do a little Nostradamus with us here, if you would? What do you see in the relationship going forward?
I think the relationship is going to sour. You know,
Why is that?
I think that Trump's association with Russia was always in the terms of business deals or potential business deals and the Miss Universe contest. You know, Russians know how to treat a foreign business leader very well and make them very happy. I think that when it comes to actual power, geopolitical power politics, it's not going to work.
And what's it going to mean? Meaning continued conflict in Syria?
The same kind of standoffs that we would have seen if Hillary Clinton had been elected. You know, there are a couple of things that we need to cooperate with Russia on. We need to cooperate on nuclear proliferation. It would be nice if we could cooperate on Ukraine and on Syria. But Vladimir Putin has proven himself to be completely untrustworthy on both
and
those
Vladimir
issues.
Putin, we're almost out of time, but how long is he going to last?
Oh, I think for life.
For life.
For life. This is a man who can't afford to leave.
How old is he?
He is about 63, 64 so now.
What do you mean he can't afford to leave?
Well, he has no successor. You know, if you're an autocrat, you have to have a trustworthy successor. So ideally, it should be.
Well, he theoretically had one who's now in trouble. Does he not? I mean,
well, Medvedev was never really thought of as being the successor. Need somebody. He's thought of always as being a kind of a weak guy and a little bit too Western leaning.
Yeah, he's got all those yachts and estates and vineyards and stuff like that, a little bit too much money being spent there. Exactly. So he could have Vladimir Putin for another 20 years.
Yes.
Okay, that's good.
Corey, it was really thrilling to meet you. Thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure to be here and to meet you both.
Yes. Corey Flintoff worked as a reporter for over 40 years. He recently retired. He covered the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Ukraine, the earthquake in Haiti, the revolution in Egypt, and the revolution and civil war in Libya. He most recently served as NPR's correspondent in Moscow. Up next, we look at the origin of Stand Your Ground laws and what British castles have to do with it. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're on tape today, replaying some of our recent conversations, which includes the one we had with Harvard professor Caroline Light on her latest book about Stand Your Ground laws. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie. And when we talk about America's gun culture and self-defense, one line of reasoning we hear a lot is the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
You know what a gun-free zone is to a sicko? That's bait. That's like gun-free zone. And then they walk in with whatever the hell they're carrying. I will get rid of gun-free zones on schools. And you have to. And on military bases, my first day, it gets signed, okay? My first day. There's no more gun-free zones.
The origins of our self-defense attitudes and laws, and who actually benefits from them, is the subject of Caroline Light's new book. It's called Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. Caroline, it's a pleasure to meet you. Congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Caroline, thank you very much for coming in, and congratulations for doing a wonderful look at the history of this whole thing. But correct me if I'm wrong, but it's one of your major conclusions is Stand Your Ground is about standing your ground if you're a white guy. It's not about standing your ground if you're a woman or an African-American or a person of color.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. I conclude that in spite of a lot of language that supposes that this is a universal right to stand our ground, that in reality it's really based on very exclusionary principles that favor particular kinds of people who very often happen to be white guys with property standing their ground against criminalized others. So it actually puts the bulk of the population in serious danger.
Can you do a little bit of that? One of the interesting things about which I knew absolutely nothing is the history, how we sort of got here and why it does benefit one piece of the population. Now, give us like the Cliff Notes version of your history of this. No, I mean, really, and people hopefully will go by the book, of the history of this lethal self-defense thing.
So to try to make a long story, really long story, short, I try to trace this back to before there was a United States. I look back at English common law doctrine. I look at the Castle Doctrine, because this is something that floats around among the gun rights people, among the folks who are supporting Stand Your Ground laws, that it's about the Castle Doctrine. Well, in reality, the Castle Doctrine was the one exception in English common law to the duty to retreat. Under English common law, you were obligated to retreat to the wall behind your back if someone came after you. You weren't allowed to fight back to kill them. So that was under original English common law. The one exception was the home. A man's home is his castle. So in my story, I'm trying to unpack exactly whose castle. was exempt, exactly whose castle was deemed sacred. And what I find over time, not surprisingly, is that in the context of the United States, the parameters of that castle grew and grew and grew for certain people and shrank for certain others.
You know, most of us never heard of the castle doctrine,
mm-hmm.
nor Stand Your Ground, obviously, until the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman situation.
Yes.
What's the genesis of Stand Your Ground as state legislation? Where did that all begin and why did it begin?
So the first state to pass a Stand Your Ground law was Florida in 2005.
And was that NRA woman? Was that the woman
yes.
who was? Yeah, tell that
yes,
story.
Yes, Marion Hammer.
Yeah.
And she's still out there. She was a president of the NRA at one time.
You don't mean out there. You mean she's still
around.
There. Okay,
she's
fine.
Around.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, not out there, but okay. out there in, ideologically. So she promoted this thing that became the Stand Your Ground law back starting in 2005, I would say. And it was promoted as a way to protect not just homeowners, but to protect all people who felt themselves subject to threat. And her particular story was very persuasive. She told the story over and over again. She is an older white woman who said that back in the 80s, she found herself pursued by a truckload full of thugs, quote unquote thugs, in a parking garage. And she, rather than back down and run away, stood up with her gun and scared them away. So she tells the story of her heroic effort to protect herself. And then she said that in most states, you're not allowed to protect yourself, that actually you have to back away, that the duty to retreat would force you to run away when someone comes after you. That is not, in fact, true. Actually, if you are under threat and you have nowhere to run and you can't get away, you are allowed to fight back. But she and gun rights supporters and the NRA framed it as if we desperately needed additional legal protection to protect ourselves. So that's how we ended up in 2005 and then shortly thereafter many other states passing.
How many states have it now, by the way?
About 33. It depends on how you look
stunned.
At it.
I was stunned. I was stunned by that.
Over half the states.
Yeah, that is just incredible.
I know.
And you know what the other thing that I was not stunned about, because I remember when it happened here, the case of the Framingham 8, famous case here in Massachusetts, where women who had been battered and beaten by their significant other and spouses in these women's cases, they eventually fought back, and it was became known as the Framingham 8 because they wound up in Framingham State Prison. You talk about this case I did not know about, this Pamela Smith.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened to her as well as how she has been used by gun rights advocates.
So these cases are happening all the time. I'm so glad you raised the Framingham 8. I don't talk about them in my book, but they're a great example of
the extent
to which...
Oh, my goodness, I thought I read about them right in one of these pieces.
So not in the actual book, but they're a great example, and Pam Smith as well, are examples of how women who are subject to intimate partner violence, when they try to stand their ground against their male partners, they typically end up going to prison. Marissa Alexander is another great example. Specifically, Marissa Alexander is a black woman who stood her ground. She didn't even shoot her violent spouse. She shot a warning shot and ended up going to prison in a stand your ground state. Pam Smith is from Kentucky. She's a more recent case. I believe her case was April 2016. NRA supporters, gun rights activists pointed to her as a woman who protected herself from her violent spouse with a gun. She shot him dead. Where is she now? She's in prison. The fact is that when women stand up against their male abusers, the law does not protect their right to stand their ground. And Stand Your Ground laws are not helping them at all.
But you were delving in something that is not very relevant in 2017, namely facts. It seems to me that...
facts.
They were really yesterday's news.
Right.
But I'm serious. When people like Wayne LaPierre, who everybody knows, the VP of something at the National Rifle Association, says things like, the one thing a violent rapist deserves to face is a good woman with a gun. My guess is, despite your exhaustive research, I haven't seen polling, a huge swath of the American people, if not a majority of the American people, believe every single word he says, right?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you're going to be faced with gun violence, then you should be able to counter gun violence with gun violence, right?
Right.
Self-protection. So how do you disabuse people? I mean, facts, I meant it facetiously, facts are not stories. I mean, how do you persuade people that what seems to make sense on its face, LaPierre's statement, is in fact belied by reality?
That's the million-dollar question, really, is how to persuade people that this is actually not making anybody safer. There's that ages-old mythology that a woman with a gun can fight off a rapist. But what it obfuscates is the fact that women are more often subject to sexual violence and generalized violence by people that they know, men that they know. Mm-hmm. So there's a mythology here with Wayne LaPierre and others, supporters of guns in response to gender violence, that women are most subject to threat by criminal strangers. So it's all wrapped up in this sense of criminal strangers that are threatening us, when in reality, women are most often threatened by their lovers, their exes, their boyfriends.
In addition to the gender issues, which you raised wonderfully, some of the racial issues, or I don't remember the exact numbers, but I'm sure you do, Understand Your Ground Laws, the percentage of people, a white person who shoots a white person who's convicted, as opposed to a white person who shoots mm-hmm. a black person. Give us those numbers, if you can.
I don't have a great head for numbers, but one of the studies says it's 11 times more likely for a white person to get acquitted for killing a black person and claiming self-defense. And part of the, and it's a very complicated story, but the bottom line is our legal system doesn't really have the space for understanding a reasonable threat through the eyes of a sort of critical look at the implicit biases of our culture. In other words, judges, juries, prosecutors don't think it's reasonable for a person of color to see a white person as a threat, but they can imagine it being reasonable for a white person to see a black person with a threat. So to see for George Zimmerman to have seen Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old black young man, as a threat to his life.
That's the voice of Carolyn Light. The book is Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. That's what I wondered if you know, is it just the whole court system? I mean, we've everybody's Michelle Alexander's Jim Crow laws talks about the outrages in the court system. But is it just throughout? Is it the juries, the judges, and the prosecutors? It's everything.
It's the whole culture. I mean, yeah. I use the law as my text because it's something readily accessible I can look at. But as Michelle Alexander and Patricia Williams and many others have shown us, the law is a product of our culture and our history. And for me, it was important to look at the specific ways in which our history has framed the contours of lethal self-defense as something that we might celebrate as being a universal human right, but in reality, especially today, it's very selective.
And in the domestic violence cases, like the Framingham 8, is it that people think, well, why did she let him in the house?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, so with Pam Smith, that was the big question there, is that, well, she let him in the house and she had been carrying on a relationship with her estranged husband in spite of a court order. So protective orders, et cetera. But this is all classic to domestic violence. It's complicated.
Right.
Our dominant society doesn't want to see how difficult it is for women to extricate themselves from abusive relationships. Our court system, everything, it's misogyny and it's racism and classism all wrapped up into one big mess.
You know, Caroline, a couple of minutes ago, you were talking about and answering my question about the history here, about the English common law. So how do you explain that we, the United States, basing our laws on English common law and then evolving from there, have this gun culture that is unlike any others in the Western world, and England itself doesn't have a gun culture that's anywhere near what we have? Is that all Second Amendment related? But it's more than just what the Constitution says. There is a culture around it. But why didn't they derive it from their own common law and we derived it from the same common law?
I think it's a whole bunch of different things. I mean, it is about the Second Amendment, but more importantly, it's about the interpretations of the Second Amendment that have threaded through our history. It's about the specific economic structure here. I talk a lot about slavery and settler colonialism, the way in which the United States took shape specifically as an effort in Manifest Destiny for Christian European descended men to spread their ideas of civilized progress from sea to shining sea. And that's all wrapped up in this sort of package that saw it as vitally necessary for white men to go out there with their weapons and protect themselves. So this is a discourse that is woven all the way through our history. What is unique in this moment, what has produced these stand your ground laws, et cetera, is that there's a phenomenon now where it's more widespread, crosses ideological divides, where many of us are seeing ourselves as urgently in need of lethal self-defense.
You know, I just wonder if you thought much about the politics of this, because, you know, every time there's some horrible disaster, and the most horrible was, of course, the Newtown shooting of the children, people talk about, well, you know, we should maybe not have guns for people with that are mentally defective. That just got turned around by the Trump administration. Well, maybe we shouldn't have high-capacity magazines. Well, maybe we shouldn't have assault weapons. And we get absolutely nowhere, even though many members of the NRA, and correct me if I'm wrong, do think that background checks are reasonable.
Yeah.
And that some of these restrictions, like on, you know, terrorists getting guns, et cetera, are reasonable. But we're going New Hampshire now. Don't they have now that you can have a you don't need a license to have concealed carry in New Hampshire?
They're voting on this. Yeah,
yeah.
This is called constitutional carry. There are, I believe, 12 states now that have basically you can be a civilian carrying a weapon, concealed carrying, without any training and without a license. So that's called constitutional carry. It's in, I believe, 12 states now, and New Hampshire's about to possibly join them.
Yeah, so it just seems to be I'd be nervous about going to New Hampshire if that were
I know
the
there
case.
Are I neighbors.
I don't want to go into the 7-Eleven and see people with guns in their waist. It would make me very nervous. But anyway, what do you see as the possibility of making any inroads? Particularly, we have a Republican president now with a Republican House and Congress. They've not been big on gun rights. Is it hopeless?
Well, okay, yes and no. I mean, I think our president was elected with tremendous monetary support from the NRA. So there's no accident, and he's not shy at all in expressing his support for unfettered gun rights. Yeah, I'm very worried that the response, as you mentioned, to mass shootings, to those horrific tragedies for which the United States is known among all other peer nations, is more guns. I mean, for many people, if only there had been one of those teachers at Sandy Hook who was armed, that there would have been much less loss of life. They're wrong because more and more guns means more and more gun deaths. And all the research from experts amounts to statistics showing that more people die when there are more people with guns.
You know, one of the reasons I feel so hopeless about this, I should say, which is not a wonderful way to end a conversation with someone with all this research. One is Sandy Hook, where, you know, we all said if 20 kids and 6 adults can't do it, 26 and 7-year-olds can't do it. But we should be fair here. Barack Obama had 2 years with the Democratic Congress, and the only two gun laws that he signed into law expanded gun rights. They allowed certain carry on Amtrak. They allowed certain carry in national parks. So while I love the fact that Joe Biden ultimately tried to lead the charge with the parents of some of the parents of Sandy Hook, they were a little late to the fair, too. They can, just like with the Affordable Care Act, which they passed with no Democratic Republican votes, if this was the top priority for them, there would have been reform in the first 2 years of his administration. Maybe we'd be talking about repealing it. But the point I'm trying to make is it's a bipartisan problem.
Oh, absolutely.
Surely not just a Trumpian or a Republican problem.
No, okay, Jim, I shouldn't have just blamed the Republicans.
No, it's a problem now. But I'm saying there seems to be an inability to. And, you know, when you people like John Rosenthal, who we talked to a lot to stop handgun violence, would say something like, you know, while we're obsessing on the whole country is obsessing on keeping some immigrants out who have no history since 2001 of doing us harm. How many gun deaths are there a year? 15,000, 30,000, whatever it is. It's sort of like this elephant staring us in the face. And again, as you and Marjorie said, with support for at least some modest reforms that people just can't deal with. Having said that, I know this is not just to make you feel good for a minute. Facts are the only thing you can infuse the debate with now in the hopes that saner heads someday begin to prevail. But surely they have not prevailed.
And I think what you speak to, though, is there's a real seductive promise to this idea that if I just carry my own weapon with me, I will be safe. Not only will I be safe, but I can heroically intervene if I'm at a nightclub and somebody starts shooting or something like that, or I'm in a school.
But do you understand? I mean, I have to say, even though I would never do it only because I'd end up shooting myself.
Oh, me too.
But I feel the same way. I understand the emotional appeal of that, particularly when you live through an Orlando or a Sandy Hook. I mean, that's the problem with that. It's not just
people who are the so-called. That's where my hope comes from. So I don't want to leave it with a completely, you know, on a completely demoralized note.
No, I'll just be demoralized. You don't have to be.
I'm going to try to bring just a note of optimism here, is that as I show in my book, those of us who are subject to the violence, those of us who are most at risk in this culture, are in the vast majority. There are so many more of us. All we have to do is realize the extent to which this naturalized understanding of lethal self-defense as our solution to any and all security concerns and threats is harming us. And there's a body count for this ideology. So I feel like we need this wake-up call. It needs to be a bipartisan wake-up call. I feel optimistic that that can happen.
Great. Glad you do. Like, go buy the book.
Caroline Light is Harvard University's Director of Undergraduate Studies of Women, Gender, and Sexuality. Her latest book is Stand Your Ground, A History of America's Love Affair with Lethal Self-Defense. Up next, Harvard historian Nancy Cain joins us to talk about the new Museum of the American Revolution. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're on tape today, replaying some of our favorite radio conversations, which include the one we had recently with Harvard historian Nancy Cain about the responsibility of memorializing war. Plato said only the dead have seen the end of war, but is it the duty of the living to learn from it? The Museum of the American Revolution opens in Pennsylvania, and the New York Times describes it as a warts and all account of the historic fight for independence, a history where freedom for America did not necessarily mean freedom for slaves or independence for Native Americans. Joining us to talk about the challenges of curating wars, which I never thought about till yesterday, and what the mission of a war museum should be is Harvard historian Nancy Cain, who has thought about it. Nancy is the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Hi there, Nancy Cain.
Hi there.
How are you?
Let's talk, because I'm sure a lot of our listeners want to get your take on the 9/11 Museum in Manhattan at the site of where the World Trade Tower stood. But just talk about this new museum is opened up, warts and all, as Jim said. So did they get it right in this Revolutionary War Museum?
And what is getting it right?
Well, we don't know whether they got it right because only a few select people have been in it. What we do know is that it is of a new breed of museums, like the Abraham Lincoln Museum in Springfield, Illinois, like the Holocaust Museum in Washington. I've not been to the new African American Museum, but museums
that are for months.
Right, that are experiential. Right, it used to be museums were kind of books. You walked in and you looked at pages of books in different forms. It was a kind of passive intake for the audience member or for the participant. I use that word. You know, for the new museum, you walk in and you experience different things, right? You take a number in the Holocaust Museum as if you are going to be, you know, a victim of the Holocaust. Here in the American Revolution Museum, the Museum of the American Revolution, there are all kinds of ways in which you experience different moments of the revolution. They have George Washington's actual tent.
His actual tent.
It's been packed away since 1997, right, in a museum that houses Valley Forge artifacts. And now it's there. And you can't actually walk into it because the fabric is, whatever, 240 years old. But you can get real close to it. And so the idea is that you get a sense, right, not only of what it might have been like to be George Washington or be a New Yorker trying to, you know, topple a statue of George III, who was king then, but what it might have been like to be, an a Native American, and trying to figure out what does a change in regime, right, the loss of the British as mother country mean for my tribe's independence. So it's again, it's a new moment, and I think a very important moment in trying to make history accessible for a different age of people whose attention spans are shorter, who are used to participating via multimedia experiences. And last but not least, it's also to this title that you invoke, Warts and All, the New York Times article, it is yet the ongoing attempt of one generation, this generation, the generations alive today, to see history in a way that, say, generations 75 years ago, 50 years ago, did not. So there's a revisionist.
What does that mean?
That you know, many historians, most recently David Cannadine, a well-known historian of the British aristocracy, have said every generation rewrites history in some sense with regard, conscious or not, to the priorities of that age.
Yeah.
So, right, in an age in which all kinds of minorities, people who have not traditionally had social and economic and political power, have, despite this moment in American political history, you know, gained lots and lots of access and changed that, become more included, we would expect a museum in some sense that built during this time, put together during this time, to reflect a bunch of views that weren't on offer if we'd gone to, say, this museum during the bicentennial,
right?
Some 40-some years ago, which, by the way, this museum is built on the site of a former bicentennial museum.
So tell me about the 9/11 Museum and what we've done there. It is very interactive. Adam Gopnik, who is one of my favorite writers at The New Yorker, he's wonderful. He reviewed it, criticized it. He seemed to think that it was a little bit too over the top in some sense. And it is a very tough thing. One of the things they do at the 9/11 Museum, which is fascinating, is they have people calling from the Twin Towers while they were still standing to their loved ones. And some of these people, and they showed you what floor they were calling from, and that determined, of course, whether they get out or whether they didn't get out. That was just riveting. But there was something, I got what he meant. It was almost over the top in some ways, the 9/11 Museum.
So let me just, for our curious listeners, particularly those that have been to this museum and want to follow up on Gopnik's lengthy, review.
Very lengthy.
But he tells you a lot about it. If you haven't been there, it's worth reading. It's called Stones and Bones.
Yep.
And it's, I believe it's from, bear with me, I believe it's from, yes, the 7th of July issue, 2014. So you can get it online. I got it just by linking, by following the links. And he makes an argument, I think, that's, and I've not been to the museum, so you are much better qualified to speak to this than I, or perhaps you, Jim.
I haven't been there, no.
But he makes the argument that it's caught in a couple of different currents, that he says it's Manin versus memory. It's the commercial aspects of the new World Trade Center that went up, and the park, the kind of urban park that has these, you know, kind of memorial waterfalls.
Yeah.
It's caught between the commercial needs of the space and what happens to urban plazas, and the need to, in some sense, allow viewers, participants, visitors, to make sense of 9/11 for themselves in a new, deeper way. And he says it's a very difficult thing to do. And he says, to your point, he's not sure it succeeds, right? Because they're pulling at different chords. They're pulling at these important heartstrings. And yet, as he says, a whole bunch of stuff isn't there. We only see these tiny pictures of the actual
hijackers.
And
they're at the end.
At the very end. And we learn nothing, in some sense. And he riffs on this at the end, but without riffing on it because it's in the museum, because he says it isn't, we learn nothing about, say, their real motivations, right? And what that has to say about the view of America or why this happened. Because even though this is a museum, it's not quite in the same catalog of other museums in terms of a conflict. It's about an event in American history that was related to the War on Terror, but it's an event, and it was a cataclysmic or inflection point event.
Well, what do you mean when you said over the top? Stay on that just for one second, because you're the only one of the three of us that's been there. Over the top how?
You see things, you see people's watches. You see a letter on yellow legal pad from a guy that was on the 84th floor saying, "We're here on the 80th floor, come save us." He did not survive. You see wallets. You see all these artifacts of people, most of whom are dead, that survived. There's a weird thing about going in, and he mentions this, how the security is intense.
Yeah, he said you go through like several different screens and conveyor belts.
Which is kind of weird. And he also talks
talks about how they monitor the what people are doing on the outside. They have these big, huge pools, which are supposed to, I thought, kind of create, this is eternity. These are people going through eternity. But he talks about them different. He calls it like this, the water running through and recycling as this endless cycle of loss and waste, which is a pretty depressing way to look at it. I thought the pools were pretty moving myself with the names of all the people that died. But it's almost, you know, people talk about real estate pornography. It's almost like 9/11 pornography in a way. It's almost too much. And he talks about the fact that that we are so ready to be offended by missteps in the United States of America that that there was too much of a committee effort here. You know, you had the victims' families deciding what it should be. You had the artists deciding what it should be.
You had the developers with a role in this as well.
The developers deciding what it should be. So it's definitely worth seeing, and it's a real depleting experience because you are so upset. One of the great things, though, and then I'll shut up, is when you go into the museum, the pools are outside. Mm-hmm. You go way down in underground into this museum, and what you go down is as you're going down, you see the slurry wall of the World Trade Tower. I forget if it's the North or South Tower that survived, the underneath wall. And you are underground in this museum for the whole time you're there. And you see some things that did survive, like a staircase that survived. And you also see the packed floors that are squished together that happened when the towers fell. And you see like a crushed fire truck. He mentions that in his story, the crushed fire truck you see. But there's something, to me, a little bit over the top. Other people would disagree. That's how it struck me.
Is there, you know, one of the things, getting back to what Nancy said a minute ago, is there, because I haven't been there and I've only read a piece of this story in The New Yorker, do they focus at all on Bin Laden et al., or is
about... No, almost nothing.
No.
Well, you know what this is like, by the way? You know, it's interesting. While I'm sitting here...
Because people objected to that. They
I understand. I'm standing here saying I have a problem with that, but yesterday I was praising the HBO documentary on the marathon, when we were talking to Patrick Downs and some others yesterday, which focused almost exclusively on three families who were survivor families and barely mentioned the Tsarnaevs in passing. So it's not only in documentaries, but in museums of times of violence and war. That's a decision they're obviously got to make, no?
They absolutely have to make it. And by the way, I thought that Patrick Downs, who I had not heard on the show before, was just
terrific.
Astounding. I sat in my car, and it was a garage moment.
Right.
You know when you can't stop listening to your show?
That's how I feel every time I talk.
And I was weeping at the end when he was describing first his wife and then his own interest in social change. Talk about leadership.
Yeah, he's a
so
great guy.
So it is an important choice, though. I mean, first of all, the death and the crime are not the lives lost and the ultimate meaning. It's not that they're trivial. It's like people get fascinated by Abraham Lincoln, and often the way they walk into the door of interest in Lincoln is because of his assassination. But the death is not the life. So,
So
museums are walking that curious kind of balance and making those trade-offs of we actually want, I say this we because I'm such a great believer in museums because they open up our minds and they make us want to pull information and gain understanding. But museum supporters, consulting historians, we want people to walk in the door and get interested and make something good for themselves out of it. So how do you make those fine trade-offs, right? Because sometimes the thing that draws you in is actually the sensational, right? It's sad, sad but true, right? You know, John Wilkes Booth is fascinating to people, but actually if he's a gateway into who Lincoln became, well, that's a heaven-sent
gateway.
Yeah, but
without him and without Bin Laden and his people, and to a degree without the Tsarnaevs, you don't learn the whole history.
You don't learn.
And
I think we've become overly sensitive to that because if you go to Europe and you see museums, or I don't know what the Holocaust in Washington's like, but we see a lot about Hitler, World War II. We see a lot about the rise of the Nazis and the Third Reich and all that kind of stuff. You go to the Martin Luther King Museum, which is unbelievable, and you see a recreation of the bathtub that James Earl, what was the last name of the
Ray.
Killer?
Right.
James Earl Ray, thank you very much, was in shooting out the window to kill Martin Luther King. You hear a lot about Ray. So I think it was an oversight to so downplay the terrorists.
I agree. And because, again, as someone who feels like she's an upholder, part of her job is to uphold the historical record. That's an important part of the historical record, right? And museums will more and more be ways that we start to learn history because we're going to learn it in different ways than we once did. Let me say one more thing about the warts and all piece of all these places. And by the way, there's an interesting new museum getting underway in Gdansk, speaking of war museums,
yes,
in Poland, about the Polish experience during the war. And it's a warts and all place, too. Fascinating article. Let me just refer our dear listeners, because it's really interesting. And this is from The Guardian, I believe. Yes. January 28th of this year. Dispute over patriotism delays opening of Gdansk's new war museum. And it is caught. It's about the whole picture in some sense, right? Not just Polish soldiers and Polish citizens and resistors to the Nazi rule. Not just what was it like September 1st, 1939, when the Panzer trucks, right, from the Luftwaffe or the Wehrmacht marched, rolled in, but also what did it mean, right, for Jews in Poland or other Poles, Gypsies, other Poles that became victims of the Final Solution. And it's a warts and all place. And interestingly enough, it's now caught in politics where a new regime coming into power wants to make this more patriotic and eclipse the historical record some so that visitors don't get the whole picture. Last point. Warts and all, what really strikes me about all these museums that we're talking about is, and this larger issue about do we airbrush history, is we don't want to airbrush it. We're going to create museums and exhibits around our own priorities. There's no way we can completely separate them from that. We owe fairness to the truth and the record. But the last piece is a piece that, you know, Patrick Downs?
Yes. Yeah.
One thing they remind us of is that progress doesn't come in big, inevitable bolts of lightning. It comes in fits and starts, in warts and all, right? And it, as King said, the wheels of justice do not roll inevitably in. We got to keep working.
Nancy Cain joins us every week. She's the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her forthcoming book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Coming up, we've got our Cinema Classic Challenge, asking you if Dr. Strangelove still holds up. We're also going to talk to Dr. Stuart Mushlin about cracking medical mysteries. All that and more is coming up in Hour 2 of Boston Public Radio. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. If you're just tuning in, we're on tape today, replaying some of our favorite conversations, which includes the one that we had with Dr. Stuart Mushlin about his latest book on cracking medical mysteries. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And while we've been focusing a lot lately on how to pay for medical care, we're now going to focus on how to practice by way of a new book. It's called Playing the Ponies and Other Medical Mysteries Solved. It's by Dr. Stuart Mushlin. He's the medical director of Brigham Circle Medical Associates at the Boston Brigham and Women's Hospital and assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Stuart Mushlin, it's great to see you. How are you?
I'm great. Good to be here.
Okay, now, Stuart, before we get into the details of Playing the Ponies and Other Medical Mysteries Solved, when I told Jim about your book, that you were a diagnostician.
Don't do this.
Jim here has had the record. He has had more MRIs than any person we think in Massachusetts, possibly even America, since the machine was invented. So looking at him here, is there anything amiss?
Can you solve the mystery?
What is wrong with Jim?
Okay.
He's got so many problems.
Why have a headache when you can have a brain tumor?
Except
right?
Beautifully that, put. That, that's such
Woody
a
Allen
lovely
said.
Motto. Thank you. We don't quote him anymore, but
exactly,
thank you, Stuart.
Exactly. So you've got a million great stories in this book about diagnosing people and why and the things that they really had that took a while to get to. But there were others that were, well, tell us about the woman that had the heart attack.
Oh, yeah. Actually, that's my favorite story.
It's a great story.
Yeah. So it exemplifies a lot of what being a doctor is about. In the sense that I had misread this woman. She was this kind of Boston, very proper, well-to-do Boston lady, and she was married to this great guy who was had a big congregation, was a priest, having gone to Harvard College, and was a Marine. And, you know, she kind of always sat there with her silver-haired braids and Birkenstocks when they were in the office, and I just always thought that everything was put together with her. Anyhow, to make a long story short, they were at the summer cottage up in Maine, and
they always call them cottages, those
right,
big mansions right. on the ocean, right?
Exactly.
Little cottage.
So her husband had a heart attack, and she called me, and it was clear to me he was having a heart attack. And about 8 hours later, after he got taken away by EMS to the hospital, she developed the same exact symptoms. And she had something called broken heart syndrome or Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, which means octopus trap. And you can get a heart attack just from having a broken heart.
Isn't this Debbie Reynolds Carrie Fisher?
Yeah.
I mean, within 24 hours of each other. Yeah, the mother after the daughter.
Could well be. Actually, a relative of my wife's just recently, who's the poor thing has a terrible existence because she's got chronic pain after a bad operation and lives in Canada. And anyhow, we heard that she was found down in her apartment, and the diagnosis was the same thing. And I suspect she's just so miserable and unhappy that, her heart tried to die.
Wow.
You know what's amazing to me, though? It's so obvious to me as a non-medical person that there is that mind-heart-body connection. Your colleagues don't like that because it's not it's sort of not like a book learning kind of medical thing. Is that what it is?
Yeah, Jim. You know, one of the problems is the way you get into medical school is you love metrics. Give me numbers. You know, let me measure something. And the truth of the matter is if you're going to be a bench medical scientist, that's a good thing. You know, you do measure stuff. But you can't measure this. How do you know how much stress is enough to cause a heart attack in this person versus that person? So I think all this mind-body stuff, particularly when it relates to cardiac, is difficult to quantify, and a lot of doctors feel uncomfortable with things they can't quantify.
It's a voice of Dr. Stuart Mushlin. His book is Playing the Ponies, Another Medical Mystery Solved. So she, Mrs. T.C., felt she had been dismissed as a whiner and complainer, which is essentially what Marjorie does to me every day on the air.
A lot of whining goes on here.
Her symptoms had been increasing weight loss, depression, I can't even pronounce this word, which stands for lack of enthusiasm for life, sex, fun, etc., and
anhedonia.
Exactly what I was going to say.
I went out with Ann in college.
I bet you did. But I'm fine. He'll be in the lounge, by the way, right after the show. Palpitations, headaches, light sensitivity, cold extremities, confusion, and multiple food sensitivities. What happened with her?
Yeah, she taught me a lot. She had something very real due to dysregulation of her brain. A lot of folks she had seen didn't recognize that dysregulated
state. What's that mean?
Well, in your brain's, a lot of our brain in the autonomic nervous system, which means it's on autopilot, works like the thermostat in your house. Gets a little too cold, thermostat says, ooh, it's cold, the heater turns on. A lot of our fundamental autonomic nervous system works that way. And this woman lost one of those regulatory inputs, and so everything was just not a little bit, it was wild. You know, if there was some perturbation, it wasn't a small one, it was wild. And what she taught me when we finally figured it out, and I might add, when I say we finally figured it out, I'm not using the regal we. I mean, I work in a place where I have so many capable people to help me. That it's rare that a doctor nowadays just gets the answer on their own. You pick people's brains and they let you pick their brains for free. So when we, all of us, finally figured out what was up, she educated me a lot because she went out on the internet and I hadn't thought about her condition in years, and what I did know about it was not enough. And she taught me a tremendous amount.
Well, didn't she end up, too, doing a lot of meditating to help?
Yeah.
And that really, there was a mind-body connection there, too. But she ended up needing some blood pressure medication or something
like that? Yeah, because that was the main part that was became unregulated. So, you know, let's say we all get in an argument here and our blood pressure goes up. Well, her blood pressure, if she got in an argument, say, with her spouse, would go way up. Dangerously high. And by the same token, if she took a pill to bring it down, it wouldn't go down to normal. It would go down to subnormal.
So as you said before, a lot of this is
art as much as science too, just trying to
figure out the fun.
Yeah, that's the So when you in your regular life, when you're not at the Brigham and you're out with, you know, a party somewhere and people find out what you do.
Yeah, it's
you
must usually get, a party.
Yeah. Right? You must get hounded all the time. Dr. Mushin, can you something's wrong with my back, something's wrong with my foot, something's wrong with my whatever. How do you handle that?
This usually does happen, and the bad news is when they pull down their pants.
Really? Has that actually happened?
Yeah. Depends on who it is, I guess.
Really?
You can say,
yes,
Dr.
it has happened.
Exactly.
Doc, you know, I've had this problem back here for a long time. Do you mind? Usually they'll, you know, they'll take you into the men's room or something to show you. But
God.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But that
what I used to do, and my wife would validate this, go to a party and people would say to you, and what do? You know, and I'd say, well, you know, I sell garments, ladies' garments, because it just got so terrible to hear all these tales of woe.
Because you will get surrounded by people
I think every doctor. If they know you're a doctor, you know, let me show you this scar, or, you know, this guy gave me a new hip, it doesn't work right. What do you think? And the person is a psychiatrist.
But can I get back to this medical detective part of your life here? You acknowledge that sometimes you're wrong.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me that, without getting into a headache discussion about malpractice threats and exposure and that sort of thing, the way a doctor avoids being wrong is by not taking chances and sort of towing. Is that you're nodding your head in agreement? So tell us about the wrong, and tell us about how, when there are other doctors who try to live their professional lives like you live yours, how they're pulled back for fear of negative consequences if they, in good faith, take the wrong route.
Yeah, well, you know, malpractice is a fact that's out there, and certainly I've made mistakes in my life. And
do you admit them to patients when you've done it?
Oh, yes, yes.
Why?
Well, for two reasons. One, it's the right thing to do. Two, there's some evidence that admitting a medical error to a patient, I operated on the wrong leg, you know, kind of thing, reduces malpractice suits, because the patient knows you're a human being. You screwed up. You want to do everything you can to make it right. And whereas if you just stonewall it and pretend nothing happened and wait for the lawsuit, it's worse. So, you know, it's the right thing to do. And number two, probably there's weak evidence that it probably saves the insurers some money. Okay, so the second thing is, I fortunately didn't run my medical life worried about malpractice suits. Some people do. A lot of that is your personality. If you want to be frightened, you know, you could be frightened every moment that you're practicing. We deal in a doctor's office, particularly an internist's office or a family practitioner. You deal with uncertainty every patient you see. And there are all these logical traps you fall into. Hey, I just saw two sore throats and they were viral. Jim, you must have a viral sore throat. Mm-hmm. Where you could have a strep throat. So we deal with uncertainty. We kind of run statistics in the back of our mind every time we make a diagnosis. What's likely? Have we excluded the possibilities that are less likely? And, you know, you can do that and not worry about getting sued. And sometimes you will get sued.
We're talking to Stuart Mushin, medical doctor, physician. The book is Playing the Ponies and Other Medical Mysteries Solved. You know, you also talked about the role the spouse can play. You've got a story in here about this guy that was really morbidly obese, and I guess he missed his Vegas trip for his 50th wedding anniversary.
Yep.
But the role of his spouse in the diagnosis, how'd that work?
Oh, well, they can often give you the entire answer. So here, you know, if I couldn't figure out what's going on with someone early on, when I knew I was puzzled, I'd bring in their significant other. And just the first thing you say to a patient when you don't know what's going on is, what do you think is going on? Meaning patient. And the patient will often give you the answer. And if that's not productive, you then say to their significant other, and what do you think is going on? And if you really listen and don't dismiss it, you often, you know, it saves a heck of a lot of testing and a heck of a lot of money. Now, this woman loved to send her husband to many doctors, which was, of course, the problem. You know, I couldn't say to her, you know, he's got the sniffles when, you know, she'd send him to the three best pulmonary experts in greater Boston and Providence. So that's how he ended up on so many medications. And because our medical system is so crazy, if you're at a great hospital like the Beth Israel, I don't know what that doctor over there has treated you when I'm at the Brigham using our medical record system. So consequently, oftentimes patients are on a lot of things that you, the physician, don't know about, even if you ask them, because they don't remember.
Well, speaking about being in a lot of things, I always wonder when they ask you to fill out those forms, how much do you drink at night, you know, or are you on any illegal drugs? I mean, how many people actually say, I drink seven martinis and I'm doing crack cocaine? I don't imagine most of them confess.
No one says that, but what we usually do is we triple it.
That's the rule of thumb.
That's the doctor's rule of thumb.
You know, the thing that most of us know about diagnosticians, I can hardly say it, is you, Laurie, that played House on television. I assume you've seen that show once or twice.
Yeah.
Those are the most out there kind of crazy things. Yeah. You've not seen people with these weird.
Yeah, I have.
You have? You
know, I'll tell you, some of these cases are pretty weird. I mean, I hadn't seen leprosy arthritis
That's
ever.
Right. Leprosy. You know? Leprosy. What did that
in
look
Boston,
like?
In Boston, Massachusetts.
I think I had that, by the way. That's why. That's one of the reasons I got an MRI last week. They haven't given me the results yet.
Really?
Still, yeah.
I hope you don't have it. It's
contagious. I like to rule them out as best
leprosy.
One can.
Right. That's where you're like your fingers fall off.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyhow, so some of these cases that I talk about, the Ms. TC, she had a very unusual case. So as some of my colleagues who will take a look at the book, they'll say, wow, you know, Stuart, you were talking about some pretty far out stuff. And some of it's more mundane.
Dr. Stuart Mushlin is medical director of Brigham Circle Medical Associates at the Boston Brigham and Women's Hospital. He's also an assistant professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School. His latest book, Playing the Ponies and Other Medical Mysteries Solved. Up next, we're checking in with a totally different doctor, Dr. Strangelove, asking you if the 1960s film still holds up. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today we're on tape replaying some of our favorite discussions, which included the one we had with Garen Daly and you. It was our cinema classic challenge, asking if the film Dr. Strangelove still holds up.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
One of the best lines in the movie. This is Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. That was General Jack D. Ripper from the 1964 classic Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Wearing and Love the War. Love the Bomb. Right, my apologies. It's our cinema classic challenge for this month. We're asking you if it holds up in 2017. Here with us in Studio 3 to lead the charge is Garen Daly. Garen, it is great to see you.
Good seeing you guys.
We both watched separately last night, and both of us in love with this movie.
It really holds up nicely. I mean, Peter Sellers, I can't believe how much his physical comedy still makes me laugh.
Tell people who haven't seen it, because it is an old movie, what basically is the plot?
The plot is a Air Force general believes fake news and conspiracies so much so that he triggers a nuclear crisis to protect his essence. Meanwhile, a war room full of alleged leaders conspire to prevent the end of the world while debating a mineshaft gaffe, and a B-52 crew do their job while thinking about going to Vegas.
Exactly. I love when they pull out the Playboys, and they look so quaint, you know, compared to what you see now on these sites.
So here's a little bit of trivia. Did you recognize the Playboy model?
No.
That was Miss Foreign Affairs, who was the woman that General Buck Turgidson was having an affair with.
I did not know that.
George C. Scott, who was unbelievable in this thing.
There are so many great stories about George C. Scott and Stanley Kubrick that it's amazing, because Kubrick really manipulated Scott.
But, you know, the whole notion here, for those who haven't seen it, and I hadn't seen it in probably 25 years until last night, and I really loved every single minute. It is brilliant. It is wildly funny. It is timely. It's everything. Is when I was reading a little bit this morning, I didn't want to read anything about it in advance until I had seen it again. While some of the stuff was cooked. The notion, the central beginning premise here, that there are 12 B-52s flying around the world loaded with nuclear weapons ready to attack on a minute's notice. That was true.
That was actually true, yes.
That was happening. And it's this B-52 that gets the signal from this lunatic General Jack Ripper,
right,
which is irreversible because he's the only one who has the codes to stop them, who are on their way to drop a nuclear bomb on Russia.
Right. And the idea is to provoke a nuclear war so that they can kill the communists and prevent his essence from being destroyed.
Yeah, his essence. He talks a lot about his precious bodily fluids and that essence. And the great thing is, you know, this general there who's played by, what's his name?
Sterling Hayden. Incredible, isn't he?
Everybody is incredible.
And Peter Sellers, who's got his nice little British accent, come there. He's Mandrake. He's from the Royal Air Force, whatever he is. And you see it dawning pretty quickly on Peter Sellers that the General Ripper is nuts. And he's trying to negotiate how to get the code back from the general.
And prevent a nuclear war. Before we went on there, you were saying we should talk about the first screen.
Opening scene, yes.
The opening scene. All right, so this is called the establishing shot.
Yes.
All right, so when you look at a movie and you want to, like, say whether this is going to be a good movie or a bad movie or whatever, you look at the establishing shot to see if the director has really, you know, set the themes up within those shots. So what Kubrick has done, he's taken documentary footage, real documentary footage from the Air Force, and showed how a B-52 gets fueled in air. So you have this penis-shaped thing coming out from the plane, and this vagina-shaped thing coming in. They meet in the air.
Exactly.
and exchange fluids.
Yes.
And the thing is that what's even better and more ironic and a lot more fun is that the song underneath it is called Try a Little Tenderness.
I know, it's great.
Yeah, it's
totally
like this B-52 love scene.
Exactly.
You know? And it's so soothing at the beginning of the thing. And like I said, I watched it on Amazon Prime, and it explained some of these. It had some of these little trivia facts and different facts going down the side. So it was really kind of cool.
Well, you know what? It's when you watch, unlike you, who watch a film differently because of what you do for a living, Garen, in your life, I just watch the film. But then I'm saying to myself, there's some incredible things going on here. I read a Roger Ebert review in the late 90s, obviously decades after it came out. And one of the things I realized impressed me while I'm watching it, sort of like a stage show, which has very few places, there's essentially the general's office.
Correct.
There is the war room, this great thing with dozens of old white guys who are sitting there with George C. Scott, and Peter Sellers is president, one of the three characters Peter Sellers plays. And
The B-52.
That's essentially the whole movie.
That is.
There are three sets in this.
There were three sets. It had a very small budget, and each set had a little bit that was important. For instance, the war room. And in fact, let's play a scene in the war room when the president of the United States, Muffly, is calling Premier Kissoff in Russia about the fact that there might be a plane going to Russia to bomb them.
One of our base commanders, he had a sort of, well, he went a little funny in the head. You know, just a little funny. And he went and did a silly thing. Well, I'll tell you what he did. He ordered his planes to attack your country. Well, let me finish, Dmitri. Let me finish, Dmitri. Well, listen, how do you think I feel about it? Can you imagine how I feel about it, Dmitri? Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello? Of course I like to speak to you. Of course I like to say hello. Not now, but anytime, Dmitri. I'm just calling up to tell you something terrible has happened. It's a friendly call. Of course it's a friendly call. Listen, if it wasn't friendly, you probably wouldn't have even got it.
Peter Sellers, let me be the 4 millionth person to say, is a total genius.
Plays three roles.
Well, you're supposed to play four.
Oh, okay.
Oh, he was?
Yeah, he was supposed to play Major Kong, the B-52 pilot.
Oh, Slim Pickens.
He's Slim Pickens, and that's a whole other story about Slim Pickens. But he hurt his foot, so he couldn't do some of the physical stuff. Peter Sellers hurt his foot, so he had to cut back. And the reason that he was playing four roles or was signed up to do four roles was that Columbia, who was bankrolling this, said, well, if he's going to play four roles, we'll bankroll the film, but we won't bankroll it unless he's playing four.
You know, and the character after whom the thing is named, Dr. Strangelove, is also Peter Sellers,
right.
A former Nazi scientist,
right,
who, I mean, this is,
it's a riot.
The visual is just surreal.
When he has no control of his hand.
One of his arms,
and it goes up and says, Mein Führer, I can walk!
And then he pulls it back down, realizing
and fights it.
Yeah, he's like fighting with this arm that gets carried away.
Has a life of its own.
And
right.
The arm at one point is strangling him, and another point he's biting it, as you say, and it keeps popping up. And then he proposes. He comes in sort of late. I guess he's there, but we don't really see him until later on in the movie.
In the war room, right. In
the war room, and he proposes that since the world is all going to be blown up in just a matter of minutes, that what they do is they go down these mine shafts, and they live there for 100 years or something. And then he says it's going to be 10 women to every man. And George C. Scott perks right up.
That's a good thing. This film is incredibly sexual, okay? I mean, if you take a look at all the names of the people, Kissoff, Merkin, which is apparently a pubic hair thing. It's a British... British thing. Mandrake, Commander Mandrake, one of the Peter Sellers characters. Mandrake, the actual plant is shaped like a penis.
By the way, Jason just said in our ear, Merkin is a pubic hair wig.
A wig, okay, there we
go. Boy, I'd love to have one of those, I'll tell you.
So, but everyone in the play, I mean, Butch Turgidson, I mean, Turgidity, I mean, it's just, you know, everything, and there's these super masculine roles, as in Buck, and these kind of feminine roles, as Merkin, the president, was playing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that going on throughout the entire thing. And of course, when Slim Pickens rides the bomb, spoiler alert, down on the ICBM place in Russia, he's riding it like a Bronco or like an act of love.
There's a great scene when Slim Pickens has got this great accent, puts on his cowboy hat and says, well, I guess we're going Tojo with the Ruskies.
And here's the thing about Slim Pickens. He played it straight. That's exactly who he is. He played it straight. He had no idea it was a comedy. It's just how he is. And someone asked him, you know, afterwards, what did it do for your career? And he goes, well, the checks got bigger and the dressing rooms got better.
And by the way, James Earl Jones in a very minor role here. Was his first role?
First role in a movie. He was on TV, but that was his first movie role.
Okay, we're going to do The Lines Are Full. We're going to play one more soundbite of your choosing, and then we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and we will take your calls until 2 o'clock about a spectacular movie that you really... And the timing, obviously, is not coincidental. Dr. Strangelove.
This is the guys in the war room fighting.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room. What is going on here? I demand an explanation.
This clumsy fool tried to plant that ridiculous camera on me.
Yeah, you bet your sweets, Mr. Commie. Look at this, Mr. President. This lousy commie rat was taking pictures with this thing of the big board.
Mr. Ambassador. This clumsy fool attempted to plant that ridiculous camera on me.
That's a damn lie. I saw him with my own eyes.
Gentlemen, this is outrageous. I have never heard of such behavior in the war room before.
You know, when I think George C. Scott, I think Patton right away in serious roles. He is a comedic actor. The facial expressions on this guy are for the ages.
It's Kubrick's direction because Scott did not want to do it that way. He wanted to act it out, and Kubrick wanted him over the top. And the way that he convinced Scott to do it was they played chess all the time, and Kubrick beat him, and out of respect for him beating him in chess, he would do what Kubrick wanted him
to
do.
That's a great story.
There are so many stories to go with this in so little time, but we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come right back. We're going to get your reactions at 877-301-8970 or bpr@wgbh.org. In the age of Trump, does Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb still hold up?
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan and Garen Daly. This is your turn now. We were talking about Dr. Strangelove, which Marjorie and I saw. I guess, how long had it been since you saw it? A couple of decades yourself?
I don't know. A long time.
Yeah, me too. Decades for me. And we're talking about whether or not it holds up. Obviously, a lot of people are making connections to the time we find ourselves to be in. This is the day we learned that Ed Markey has filed a bill that would prevent President Trump from having unilateral capacity to direct first strike nuclear attacks, and this is all about the bomb, the nuclear bomb. It is spectacular. Let's take some calls. John and Gardner, you're on with Garen Daly here on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, John.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
One has to be judicious these days when to call in, but this movie, I love this movie. That was, I wanted to just pop off with my favorite quote, but you guys just did it. Gentlemen, we can't be fighting here. This is a war room.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, and then when they had that big sign outside the Army base, whatever it was, it said, peace is our profession.
And guess what?
What?
That is truly a SAC sign.
Is it that is? So?
Strategic Air Command sign. That is their motto.
John, why'd you like the movie so much?
I can't even put it into words. It's just the way it was all such a mashup of a real thing. And they made it so comedic and yet so real. I mean, and threatening, you know what I mean? Mm. It showed how things could go awry and we could have a real problem. But the way that Kubrick put it together and with the cast, I mean, it just kind of hit home while you were enjoying the movie. You know what I mean?
Oh, I know exactly what you mean. We loved it. John, thanks for the call. Thank you so much. 877-301-8970.
I just want to say, whether it's Art from West Bridgewater or Doug from the basement, everybody that's writing in is like over the moon about Dr. Strangelove. By the way, did it win any awards, or was it sort of a little dark film that people didn't even pay attention
Actually,
to?
Actually, it cost about $1.8 million to make. It grossed about $11 million, so it made a lot of money at its time. It got nominated for some awards.
It did.
Peter Sellers got up for Best Actor for his three roles, but he didn't win.
Okay.
He didn't win any roles. You know, something else to know about Stanley Kubrick, he did two other anti-war films. He did Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas, mm-hmm. and then he did Full Metal Jacket. So this was a topic of his that he was talking about,
yeah.
anti-war. And you can actually see it in Clockwork Orange and some of these other films that he did later, that this was an important theme in his work.
Okay, let us go to Travis in North Reading. What do you think, Travis?
Hey, Travis.
Finally, first-time caller. Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling.
I just moved here from Milwaukee over Labor Day weekend. This has been a tough transition, but your guys' show has really welcomed me here. Thank you for everything.
Thank you.
Nice.
First off, I a couple of years ago at the Milwaukee Film Festival, they showed a 35-millimeter print of this, and what a spectacular thing to watch in the theater. It is truly a theater-quality film still to this day. I got to be honest. The day after the election, I didn't sleep at all that night. I was panicking. I just couldn't get myself focused. This was my go-to movie. I had to watch this movie because I felt that it speaks so well in the terms of what's going on politically, but also you just have to kind of laugh at the whole situation of what we're facing here. And I mean, this is just it's truly one of the best films ever. There was no big special effects, three sets. The imagery, the design, the editing, it's got Kubrick and Scott outside of their elements doing comedy.
You know, Travis, I'm just like you. Every time I'm feeling down, I say to myself, I have to watch a film about nuclear war to lift my... No, but I am so with you. Travis, call us again soon, and welcome to Boston. Thanks so much for calling.
I want to pick up on what Travis said about special effects. So in 1963, when they made this movie, the B-52 was a top-secret plane. So they never saw it. They could never get access to it. So what they did is they went out and bought a Mattel model. And they blew that up to a 10-foot model. And then there was one picture of the cockpit that was in an aviation magazine in Britain, and they took it and reconstructed it from there. So they so when you're seeing them flying over, that's just stock footage and that they had taken with another plane and just superimposed the B-52 in it.
So the two planes having sex at the beginning are not B-52s?
But that's stock footage from the Air Force. But the flying of the plane over Russia that Slim Pickens is doing, that's a model.
And the music they play.
That's when Johnny Comes Marching Home.
Yeah.
An anti-war Irish song. And the last song, of course, is "We'll See You Again" by Vera Lynn. When the whole world is blowing.
Oh yeah, and you look at one nuclear explosion after another for about It seems like it's at least a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you said that, because even when we're talking about movies with you, Garen, that are 50 years old, people send us angry emails that we're spoiling the movie for them. And our view is, if you had 50 years to see it, then we can probably talk about the content. 877-301-8970. Dan from Weymouth, you're on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Dr. Strangelove with Garen Daly. Hey, Dan. Dan?
Hello?
You're on.
I'm on. The movie is spot on. It paved the way for me for two tours in Vietnam. It's a lot easier. And what I find very interesting, I found out in my adult life, is about Sterling Hayden. And Sterling Hayden, during the 1950s, during the Joe McCarthy era, testified against other...
Is that true?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
He was blacklisted. He was a communist. He had to own up to it, and his career suffered for it.
I didn't know that.
What he did, And if I'm not mistaken, you know, became an alcoholic, and his career ran down from that, you know. And I find it kind of interesting, the whole mess of it, you know what I mean? Just thought I'd give you another look at it.
Well, thank you, Dan, for your call. Appreciate it.
But Sterling Hayden was really, really good. I mean, he embodied it, he kept it understood, and he had that phallic symbol in his mouth the entire
cigar,
time.
That used the cigar, the whole cigar, time. Yeah. And then he was shooting, he got his golf clubs out to shoot back at the soldiers that were attacking the base.
And so the people who see the film, there is a scene where these American soldiers are attacking the Air Force base to get access to Colonel Webber to get the return codes. And it's all shot in a documentary style. That was a small handheld camera that Kubrick shot himself.
Really?
To create that documentary feel.
Was anybody doing handheld cameras in 1964?
John Cassavetes.
Oh.
Where was this in the Kubrick film? Was this early?
It was 1963. I think Spartacus was, and Paths of Glory were late 50s.
Okay.
Full Metal Jacket was early 70s.
So this is about 5 or 6 years into his career.
Well, actually, it's a little longer because he did documentaries early on.
Oh, documentaries. Okay. Yeah. All right, let's go to Mary in Medford. Hi, Mary.
Hello, Mary.
Hi. I have a comment. I saw it in 1963. I was with a friend, and the biggest laugh he got was when they attacked the phone company.
Oh, yeah. When Peter Sellers is trying, because it's old, trying to make the phone call on the payphone, and the operator's telling him he doesn't have enough change to in this emergency to call the president. Is that what you were talking about?
Yes, and this is way before there was any customer service with telephone company.
Yeah.
And everybody was just laughing their heads off because they had all had an experience with the phone company that was negative. So that was a big laugh from that movie.
So, Mary, thanks.
So to emphasize Mary's point, here's a quote from the film.
Operator, this is Group Captain Lionel Mandrake. I'm speaking from Bertelsen Air Force Base. Look, something very urgent has come up, and I want you to place an emergency person-to-person call with President Merkin Muffley in the Pentagon, Washington, D.C. Bertelsen 39180. No, I'm perfectly serious, operator. The President, yes, the President of the United States. Oh, I'm sorry, I haven't got enough change. Could you make this a collect call, operator? Just 1 second, operator. They won't accept the call. Have you got 55 cents?
Well, you don't think I'd go into combat with loose change in my pocket, do you?
That's Keenan Wynn,
right.
Who is so deadpan.
Terrific.
He's got a little bit part in this thing.
He is absolutely terrific. That's a great scene, too.
I love it when he says that group commander Mandrake convinces him to shoot the Coca-Cola machine to get the change out. And he goes, you're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
That was a great scene, too. I know, the whole thing. 877-301-8970. We're talking about Dr. Strangelove, which we just watched to see if it still holds up in 2017. And, you know, at the time, that's when people were, we were having the air raid drills where people go under their
kids
desks.
Kids under their desks, right.
So that when the nuclear holocaust came, your desk was going to protect you from annihilation.
So
that wasn't really
I don't know
work.
If they talked to you about this when you saw it on your Amazon with a little scroll mm-hmm. going down. But the scene where Slim Pickens is in the B-52 cockpit and he's listing all the things in the emergency kit, you know, chocolate bar, nylons, all this other kind of stuff. And he says, wow, guy could have a really good time in Vegas. However, if you take a close look at it, you can see that his lips are not really saying Vegas. They're saying Dallas. And the film came out right after John Kennedy was assassinated. So they changed it to Vegas.
They changed it to Vegas. Oh, that's interesting. You know what I thought was another interesting little factoid that they said in the scroll going down the side? Is that the scene of Peter Sellers, who is playing Dr. Strangelove, who is in the wheelchair and he's got this arm that keeps flapping up all the time. And it's so hysterical that they had to film it over and over again because the other actors were laughing so hysterically. And that the guy who plays the communist...
Peter Bull.
Yes. Can be seen even in the take they did use, laughing. So, and indeed, he is kind of smirking there. So it's just, you can see where they were laughing. I was rolling on the floor.
Not only that, when the original Muffley characterism that he came up with.
Merkin Muffley. How's that for a name for president?
I know. And he was.
Vote for Muffley.
So Peter Sellers had come up with this unique characterization of him that they couldn't keep anybody straight in the entire place, so he had to change his approach to it and make it more bland because people were laughing so hard. I just wish there was some test footage of that. I'd love it.
John in Boston, you're on with Garen Daly. We're talking about Dr. Strangelove, 50-some years after the fact. Hey, John.
Hello, how are you?
Great.
My comment on its holding up today is that it so very much does, because it's so directly relevant to today's situation. The movie is such a masterful balance of comedy and tragedy, you know, absolute tragedy. The mix is just absolutely perfect. And that is the potential of the situation in which we are today. Trump is a clown. That characterizes him and his administration, and the potential for absolute tragedy is there. Finally, my comment about the Slim Pickens story is that, you know, that has to be the most fortuitous injured foot of all time. I'm sure Peter Sellers would have done great in that role, but Slim Pickens just captured such a great encapsulation of the loose cannon Yahoo type of American
cowboy, right? The Southern, exactly. It's exactly right. John, thanks for a great call. We appreciate it.
So, you know, one of the things we should always mention about is that the script is really good. It really, you know,
it's great.
That was by Terry Southern. And, you know, they were actually starting to work on a sequel. It was called Son of Strangelove. And it was going to take place in the bunkers after the war. And Southern had actually spent a lot of time working on cards and stuff like that. They couldn't get the funding, but Kubrick wanted Terry Gilliam, the guy that did Brazil, to direct it. Now, and again, this is one of those things you wish would have happened.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Honoris Ethic. I'm pronouncing that wrong, no doubt. I'm sorry. Honoris, is that?
That's right.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Honoris Ethic.
Oh,
hey there,
okay.
What's up?
Hi.
I'm sorry, but my comment is so dark. I don't want to use my real name.
Oh, okay.
But I, Margie, I don't want to challenge you with your pacing the rage, but I believe that Trump is the Antichrist, and I've been reading up on Nostradamus, and that's what I think.
Okay, well, that was definitely a dark comment.
Well,
I hope you're wrong everyone's sake.
Speaking of dark comments, did you happen to notice the book that was in the war room that was always in front of either?
No.
George C. Scott and later President Muffet, Peter Sellers. It's called World Targets in Megadeths.
Oh, my God. Oh, God.
You know, I should know this. Has George C. Scott done other comedy, or was this it?
I think he did some comedy later in his career. I mean, he did the Scrooge thing. But he was always a great dramatic actor.
Darren Daly is a film critic and producer. He joins us every month for our Cinema Classic Challenge. Up next, it's writer George Saunders. He joined us earlier this year to talk about his latest book, Lincoln in the Bardo. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today we're on tape replaying some of our favorite discussions, which included the one we had earlier this year with writer George Saunders. He was in town to discuss his latest book and first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're broadcasting live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library, a perfect venue for our guest George Saunders. Known for his short stories, he just published his first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. The concept of the book comes out of the death of President Lincoln's son, Willie, but that's about as conventional as the book ever gets for an historical novel. It features 166 voices. Most of them are ghosts. Most of them are fictional, but as original and innovative as this book is, its story is as fundamentally human one, the story of a father devastated by the death of his son. George, we are thrilled to meet you. Thanks so much for being
here. Thanks for being here. What a beautiful place to broadcast.
Isn't it great?
Yeah.
I know.
Party, yeah.
It's spectacular. Yeah. It's spectacular. Well, as I said, the ladies in the book club are so excited about this because we did the short stories, and now we're doing this book this month, Lincoln in the Bardo this month. So before we get to Lincoln in the Bardo, though, you wrote a fascinating piece for The New Yorker about Donald Trump, and
much of America is very happy with him. Much of America is traumatized by him. They were traumatized yesterday at his press conference. But you spent considerable time at rallies for Donald Trump. So what did you take away?
Well, confusion. I think that's maybe the word of the day, you know. And for me, a lot of this time is to just say, yeah, it's really confusing. It seems kind of new and uncharted territory. And I went there kind of in the spring when this was still kind of a funny, freaky media phenomenon. And the first thing that confused me was that people were totally friendly, nice, happy to talk. I think from what I'd seen on TV, I expected the lunatic fringe, and it really wasn't. So that was a little confusing. And then also picked up at the time that incredible energy after rallies. You'd go from a Trump rally to a Clinton rally and like, oh, gosh, we're, you know, there's a big drop. And then the biggest thing that I'm still puzzling over is how such nice, normal people could endorse a platform that, to me, feels very hurtful to large swaths of the population. That was the big question.
But do you understand it better now that you met some of these people and were treated respectfully by them than you did going in?
Yes, for sure.
So yeah. Explain that a little bit.
Well, I mean, this is, as a fiction writer, what you find out is the craft, trying to make language better, always leads you in the direction of specificity, detail, and ambiguity, which means it leads you into greater but deeper confusion. So that was the same thing. I think then it would have been easy, as a lot of people are still doing, to dismiss the whole movement as just almost without cause. But that can't be the case. So then you hone in a little more on what the issue is. And honestly, at this moment, though still confused, I think there's something to be made of the fact that a lot of the viewpoints I heard, strong viewpoints that were then to be followed by firm action, were based, it seemed to me, on a lot of projection. In other words, and I think the polls show this, a lot of people who are Trump supporters tend to not have a lot of firsthand experience with the groups that they're involved in marginalizing. So
but we didn't go to rallies as such, and we talked to a lot of Trump supporters on the phone. Marjorie and I both went to New Hampshire for a week for the primary, and we've told this story to our listeners 1,000 times. We'll tell it to you for the 1,001st time. I can't tell you how many uncommitted voters we encountered who said, we said, who are you deciding between? And they said, well, Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
And the message that came to us in 2 seconds, I never used this word until the primary, they were looking for a disruptor.
Yeah.
They were so upset with the establishment, whether it was Barack Obama or it was that monolith government, whatever it was. Yeah. And these were two guys who were railing against, and it was almost like the details in many cases were not as important as the big message.
I think you're right.
No,
I do.
Isn't that what you saw?
I do. But the thing that concerned me about that is even then I picked up on this sort of erratic quality that we see in the Trump presidency and an inefficiency. So I think what we're finding out now is that it's not a mean feat to have a functional Democratic government. It takes a lot of buying into a central mythology, a lot of cooperation. So I think you're right about that. But I also, you know, in the piece I say maybe this is a symptom of our kind of spoiled generation, because for someone to say, I want a disruptor, indicates to me they've never been in true disruption. I mean, if you study the Russian Revolution, say you want a revolution, be careful, because it leads to chaos, it leads to cannibalism, you know, literally in the case of Russia.
You know, one of the lines he wrote, I read the thing at the time and I reread it the last couple of days, he is not trying to, this is July of last year, he's not trying to persuade, detail, or prove, he's trying to thrill, agitate, be liked, be loved, here and now. It's the exact same thing.
Same thing.
10 months later, 9 months later, right?
Yeah, except now I'm thinking, you know, then I would have said he's trying. Now I just think that's the nature of the thing. I don't think there's any trying about it. It's sort of the natural motivation.
You know, one of the things I think was so unusual about the Women's March that I happened to go to in Washington, D.C., and I have not been to any Trump rallies. I probably should have gone to Trump rallies, but I didn't. But I've been to other rallies, anti-war rallies, and different rallies. I've been a reporter all my life. Is that usually, as you point out in your piece, that there's a certain, you know, violence can happen any second, and there's and you witness young black women going after a white woman and white women going after black people. You visit it on both sides. But that the Women's March, which was probably the biggest march we've ever had, and there were a lot of men there. It was mostly women, mostly men. It was totally opposite. Excuse me, I need to go to the ladies' room, or pardon me. So what do you make of that as someone who thinks a lot about human beings, human
that,
nature.
That the world should be run by women. And, but I'm not, actually, I'm not joking. My daughter was at that rally, and she said the same thing. And I thought, you know, maybe it's time for the National Women's Party. I mean, in complete seriousness, because men seem to have something going on. So, but no, I think that, for me, I'm going around the country now, and it seems that a lot of progressives, like, I'm a little left of Gandhi, actually, but a lot of progressives like me are in this quandary, which is, should we be our usual, you know, empathetic, kind selves,
yeah,
or should we fight? And I think the answer is, yeah, you should, that's exactly right. You can fight best by being loving, by being not a pushover, be firm, say your piece, but remember that when this is all done, we have to put the country back together.
I'm sorry, Marjorie, go ahead.
Well, that was, at the end of this piece that you wrote about the Trump supporters, you made me nervous by talking about the fragility of America and that you didn't expect that we were quite that fragile. And this is what a lot of people are talking about now. Can the, and maybe they're exaggerating, I hope they're exaggerating, that these kind of sort of more authoritarian leaders come, like Donald Trump, can they really make headway in the United States of America? We've been Republic all our lives. What did you say about fragility?
Well, I said that I had to thank Trump for that I'd never really, being a person of our generation, I'd never imagined this thing could tumble. That was back in July. I think we're in the middle of it, but we're at a really interesting moment because the resistance, as you're saying, is so beautiful and dignified and individual by individual. People are becoming their own alt-presidents. And so I'm taking a lot of hope in it, actually, but I think it hangs in the balance. There's these institutions that they exist by common consent, and they also exist because of institutional memory. We all know what public civility looks like because that's what we do. It could slip. You know, so I think it's important not to get hysterical, but also not to underestimate the historical import of this moment and not to underestimate each person's importance in preserving things.
We're talking to George Saunders, and even though you wouldn't know it, he's here to talk about his book, which we will do in a couple
this is more
of seconds.
Fun. This is more
Lincoln
fun.
In the Bardo. I want to ask you one more thing, because you were immersed in these crowds. Emily Rooney and our colleague, and we were speaking at noon about a CNN report where the guy, and I can't remember the reporter's name, I'm sorry, went to Arizona the last couple of days to talk to a place of voter overwhelmingly for Trump, only talk to Trump voters. Are you disappointed, disillusioned, upset about the Russian connection? And the answer is either no, 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 and no, or no, no, no. Well, I'm upset about it, but I still love Donald Trump.
He's got this.
From having been in and around Trump supporters, what's the tipping point? Is there one? Is there a thing that he does or doesn't do that causes those who put their faith in him to say, I can't have faith in him anymore? Or are they along for the full ride?
That's the million-dollar question.
What do you think?
I would go back to what you said earlier, that there are, when I was on the campaign trail, I met very few people who were wildly enthusiastic about Trump. There was a lot of, I don't want to vote for Hillary.
Uh-huh.
I don't vote. I'm not going to vote. There's a lot of, yeah, Trump. You know, error one, error two, error three, but I'm still going to vote for him. So I think the what really matters is that middle swath of people who would be easily persuaded. And I have the sense it's happening now. People who don't like, you know, this level of disruption is not fun anymore. And those people, I think, are slow. The real sort of hardcore supporters, I think they have a lot of complicated, as anyone does, complicated emotional investment in their candidate. And one of the comic things about that piece was I just kept trotting out the arguments, and there was kind of what I call now the Kellyanne fade, which is you say there's a duck on your shoulder, and you say, what do you have against animals? You know, and you just keep going on until the argument gets, you know, fades out on its own.
Well, it's really nice of you to come by, George. Thanks. I'm joking. We're talking to George Saunders. His book is Lincoln in the Bardo.
So before we get to Lincoln in the Bardo, I was surprised. You just mentioned you were to the left of Gandhi. But you started out, I read, as an Ayn Rand acolyte.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I guess that's a lot of men, young men, get that 19, 20, 21, and that's where they stay forever. You moved.
Yeah, I grew up in Chicago, and I guess it's vaguely working class environment. Wasn't going to go to college, and a couple of high school teachers intervened on my behalf and got me in. And when I got out to the School of Mines in Colorado, I was so outgunned. You know, I could just tell that I was in trouble. And that's when this philosophy became appealing to me. You know, a way, if you feel like the scales are weighed against you, a philosophy that explains why is really, really helpful. And then, so I was sort of a mild Ayn Randian, voted for Reagan the first time. And then I went to Asia for work and saw the poverty there and saw the good people suffering. And I thought, oh, yeah, so we shouldn't make this direct connection that I understood Ayn Rand to be making between virtue and good fortune. You know, they actually aren't that linked. You know, so then I went way the other way.
Okay, yeah. We're going to get to the book now. It is called Lincoln in the Bardo, and of course the writer is here with us, George Saunders. So for those who don't know, what is Bardo, please?
The Bardo, Bardo is a Tibetan word that means transitional state, and usually it's used to talk about that state that exists between the instant of your death and whatever happens next, so say reincarnation. So it's kind of just that realm that we don't really know about, but that might be a little important.
Okay, yeah. and tell us, much of this is set in the Bardo. Explain to people.
Yeah, so what happened was, in this true story, in 1862, Lincoln's beloved son passed away, and there were reports in the newspaper that Lincoln had been so grief-stricken that he actually went into the crypt, quote-unquote, on several occasions, and somehow interacted with the body.
To hold him. Is that what the stories were?
Yes. You heard a variety. Some was just to stroke his hair, to look upon the body. So I heard this way back when our kids were little, and it was during the Clinton administration. And so I thought, my God, first of all, how does a president leave the White House alone? That's one. And second of all, the terrible pain of that. So I just kind of put that in the bag of stuff I would like to try to write about someday. But it's tough material. It's dark. It's also very earnest. So I kind of just put it aside for 20 years, and it kept bugging me. And so in 2012, I gave it a try.
Why did you put it aside for 20 years?
Well, my work is mostly kind of sci-fi, dystopian, funny.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and, I know that, but I mean, really, as relates to our conversation with Garen.
Right,
I
love that
ago.
Conversation.
Yeah.
But then, so there was just a little squeamishness that I had found a comfort zone in which I was having some success, and I felt that this was going to require more straight writing than I felt I could do. In other words, I didn't think I could find a prose style that would come alive in
well,
the story.
This is a totally different prose style, which took me, dimwit, a while to figure out. I'm thinking, why is he doing this? Tell people how you basically have these footnotes, and then you realize that these are the people that are in the Bardo, but it's like a collage.
Yeah, part of the fun for me was, okay, if you're going to write about the afterlife, it would be pretty weird if the afterlife turns out to be exactly what we think. You know, hi, St. Peter, you know, where are my wings? So I love the idea
I'm hoping they're going to be wings.
We're all hoping. Actually, there's a wonderful Stanley Elkin story called The Conventional Wisdom, and that's the conceit. Is a guy dies, and he goes up, and there's the pearly gates, and he sees St. Peter, and he says, I think I'm going to like it here. And St. Peter says, go to hell.
God.
But I thought part of the fun would be to make an afterlife that was a little freaky, you know, that wasn't what you expected, and also that the reading experience itself might be a little bit destabilizing. So by a lot of trial and error, I came up with this way where there's a something like 250 monologues in the book by 166 different speakers, but the attributions are given at the end. So I think often people will tell me they're reading, they don't quite know who's speaking, and the first 15 pages are a bit of a challenge, you know, to knock you off your feet, and hopefully that pays off at the end.
But
the beginning
story, which is a beautiful story that until the poor guy gets a beam on his head and kills him.
You gave it away.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. No. Well, it's so early in the book. Just tell people that opening. I guess you call it a chapter.
Yeah.
Of the guy that marries the younger woman.
Yeah, we just hear a voice of this guy talking. And he's saying, you know, I married this beautiful younger woman, and I know, and then she didn't love me. In fact, she was kind of repulsed by me, and I know you think I prevailed on her, but I didn't. I just waited. Of course, any gentleman would. And then we became good friends, and a couple months later, she gave me a gentle signal that it was time for us to consummate the marriage, and then the next day, he gets killed.
Yeah, so, and winds up in the Bardo.
Yeah, yeah, with a very large member. Yeah. I don't know if I can say that on the radio.
Yes, you have a lot of choice words. So I think that's it's I guess we'd say R-rated for some of the language.
R-rated?
Okay,
so
R-rated.
George.
Members,
okay.
The like any historical novel, there's a blend of fact and fiction, but is that dicier in 2017 than it might have been had this come out in 2015 when we're living in an era that is a mix of fact and fiction?
I've heard that, but I feel like we have to be really strong in the distinction, because in a work of art, you pay your money, you walk into the thing labeled novel, and you were playing a game together that involves a lot of gamesmanship and fun. And the whole point of that is to spit out some beautiful transcendent moment for you, the reader. It's kind of like when, you know, you're telling your kids a ghost story and you say, and it happened in this very room. Well, they know that it didn't, but the idea that it did makes the story better. So that's one thing. But when you're on the podium at the White House and you know, and you say A and you know B is true, that's a totally different thing.
No, I get intellectually, of course, I get the distinction. But it is odd that it, or maybe it isn't odd that it emerges in a time when that's what people are obsessed with virtually every single day.
Well, and in the fiction world, I mean, there's a really wonderful book by David Shields called Reality Hunger. And what he says is that fiction itself has been a little bit marginalized somehow around this issue, that people are hungry for fact. Mm. So this was sort of, at the time I did it, this was my way of kind of bolstering up the historical truth to make it more shapely. But yeah, it's interesting. I didn't feel any problem at all until the alt facts conversation. Yeah. I went, oh, geez.
But you're also tackling some of the big issues everybody does worry about. And by the way, I should say again, George Saunders is here with us, and the book is Lincoln and the Bardo. You're a Buddhist.
I am.
And
I try
to be. You talked about this incident on an airplane that kind of freaked you out. Tell people what happened.
Yeah, well, I was coming back. I was on a book tour like this one, and I was coming out of Chicago, heading home, just reading a magazine, and we took off, and all of a sudden it was like somebody had pulled a minivan into the side of the plane, and you just get that moment like, oh geez, you know. And I thought, if I don't close this magazine, this won't be happening. And then black smoke started coming out of those air things, and there was a girls softball team in front of us that just started panicking. The plane suddenly dropped, and there was silence, and then the pilot came on. And in a reassuring voice said, stay in your seats with the seatbelts on. I screamed it, you know. So I just noticed, you know, even then I was trying to meditate and everything. And I thought, like many of us, that at the moment when my death came, I would just be very dignified and say, it's been a beautiful ride. Thank you, everyone. And I didn't. I was just panicked beyond panic and was kind of in that state, just basically the word no repeating over and over in my mind. And so that gave me some idea of how ready I really was. And then, you know, what was beautiful was in that moment, I was sitting next to this 14-year-old boy, and I was so incredibly inside myself. And all I could think of, I got to get out of this body, and that seat right there is what's going to do it to me, you know. And so in the middle of this solipsistic, narcissistic downfall, this 14-year-old kid turns to me, and in the sweetest voice says, sir, is this supposed to be happening?
Oh, God.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that jolted me out of myself, thank God. And I could turn to him and then to the woman across. But I thought that was so terrifying, you know.
You know, George, I'm sorry.
And how did that, realizing you weren't quite ready to go down on the airplane, lead to what is this exploration of the afterlife?
Yeah. No, I think what happened then is, you know, the next 3 days were glorious. Because it didn't crash. That's
right.
But
did happen anyway? A
goose flew into the engine and took it out. Which happens, I guess. And,
oh, that was Sully Sullivan, except it was a lot of birds.
That's right, and we weren't over water.
Yeah.
And we had one engine. So it maybe felt like more of a crisis than it was. But afterwards, I said to the stewardess, no, this must happen to you all the time. She goes, never once in 30 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But I think, you know, so you're in that zone for just a couple of minutes. And the next 3 days are lit up with beauty. I mean, a French fry. What a work of art, you know. And I think that sort of stays with you, you know. And it occurred to me that the primary energy in that moment was unbelievable denial on my part. And then within two or three days, it came back. Oh, I'm not going to. I would never die because I'm me. And that was puzzling. And then also I thought, what would it be like if in your life you could sort of keep that feeling a little bit every day? Just that, I'm one day closer. Could that possibly make your life more interesting instead of terrifying?
I want you to know,
the answer is no.
I knew a French fry was a work of art even without that experience. You know, stay totally in the fact world for a second and the research you did, and I should know more about this than I do. Marjorie knows I spent an incredible 30 minutes two nights ago with Keyser Khan, who everybody got to know at the when he spoke at the Democratic National Convention, the Gold Star Father. And I interviewed him for my show last night. And you see the pain, even years later, in every sentence that comes out of this man's powerful body. What was the impact on Lincoln of the death of Willie?
Well, we know that one of the last conversations he had with his wife was they were out riding in a carriage, I think the day before the assassination, maybe the day of. And he said something like, and it's such a contemporary-sounding conversation. He basically said, honey, what a time we've had. We haven't been right with each other ever since Willie's death. Let's try to fix that, you know. So I think for the effect on her was catastrophic. And the effect on him, we don't really know. But what I came to think was, okay, you have this terrifying loss. What does it do? it tenderizes you in some way, mm-hmm. I think. Or else it breaks you. But I think you tenderize. Then you take that new tender self, and suddenly there you are in 1862.
Yeah.
You know, what does that do? And I don't know, but in the book, it kind of just... Well, and historically, you know, Lincoln, I think we love him because his empathy pod expanded as things got tougher. He came to love more people. He came to love these Americans who were being enslaved. He came to love even the soldiers on the South.
And you think in, maybe in part a function of what he experienced with his kid?
I of course, I don't know, but I can't imagine not, you know, in that
way. The shared suffering. I mean, you've talked a lot about that in the interviews you had about this book. You also talk about something, and I'm paraphrasing, but that, you know, we're all born to love, but it's all conditional. So how do you live joyfully with those two truths? By the time we're finished with Lincoln and the Bard, are we going to figure that out?
Yeah. but mostly if you buy 9 or 10 copies. That's the way it's sort of a design element.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I talk to you about something a little bit different? This is, you know, we always look at the big commencement speeches that come out over the years, and you gave one, I think it was 3 years ago, that got a lot of play. What was the theme of your speech?
You know, we have some. Do you know that?
Oh, we have. That's right.
We actually have a little piece.
That's right. Can we play the clip from the commencement speech by George Saunders? Here it is. From the commencement speech by George Saunders. Here it is.
What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was right there in front of me, suffering, and I responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly. Or to look at it from the other end of the telescope, who in your life do you remember most fondly, with the most undeniable feelings of warmth? Those who were kindest to you, I bet.
So you told this great story, and I think we can all relate to this because we were all mean little kids once upon a time, about this little girl that was in your classroom briefly. Tell people that story.
Yeah, it was kind of a small thing in a way. It was a girl who came to our school from somewhere else, and she was just kind of one of those odd, uncomfortable kids. And she had a habit of, when she got nervous, she would chew her hair. That was her thing. That was her tell, you know. And she had, at that time, these blue cat-eye glasses that were not as cool as they are now. And she just got kind of roughed up. Nothing overt, just always the butt of these sort of jokes and always at the outskirts of the crowd. And then she went away. There is no big dramatic event, but I always regretted not trying to reach out to her in some way. You know, it wouldn't have taken anything. And if I'd been 10 years more mature, I could have done it. And so that was kind of the basis of the speech, just... And, of course, that's one of the smaller unkindnesses I've done, but it's the one I could air in public.
Yeah, well, it's a great speech, and for those of us who are guilt-propelled, you should look at the speech, and it will make you reassess what you may have done when you were a kid and maybe reassess what's going on right now. We were talking with writer George Saunders about his latest book, Lincoln in the Bardo. Coming up, we continue our author interviews with John Waters. His new book is a survival guide for misfits and outcasts. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today we're on tape replaying some of our favorite discussions, which included the one we had earlier this year with filmmaker, writer, director John Waters about his new book, Make Trouble.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. One of the seven wonders of the world, despite what it says in Wikipedia, is how did John Waters become John Waters? Well, wonder no more. He laid it out in his new book. It's called Make Trouble. It's sort of a survival guide for the subversive, and it's loaded with Waters' own strain of common sense, like this tip on aging. As you get older, you'll need youth spies that will keep you abreast of the new music that nobody your age has heard of yet, or body-piercing mutilations that are becoming all the rage, even budding sexually transmitted diseases you should go to any length to avoid. You're looking wonderful. It's nice to see you again, John. How are you?
I'm well.
Well, it is great to see you again, and congratulations on another great book. But this is
from your RISD.
Yeah, this is the speech I gave. This is a bookette.
Yeah,
really.
This is
a gift item. Who would have ever imagined I would be a gift item?
It's got these unbelievably gorgeous cartoons by Eric Hansen.
Yeah, but
too.
Eric Hansen did the cover of my other book, Role Models.
He did.
That was a real memoir kind of book.
And you got a lot of gorgeous pictures of you and
weird drawings.
They're not photos. Typewriter, and then you talk about yourself as the people's pervert.
I didn't name myself that. I was called that by someone else. I'm way too humble to
but
give
you
myself
said that.
That good a title.
So okay. The parents are sitting there. They've spent $250,000 or whatever to send their kid
at
to RISD.
Yeah.
And some strange character stands up and says, I'm known as the people's pervert.
Yeah, but I addressed them, the parents, and they hugely
I know you did.
Applauded.
Did
I said,
they really?
Yes, because I said, these entitled brats. And I said, do they think that you're supposed to get used to you got horn implants and they're supposed to accept that in one day? They're supposed to understand you got a sex change yesterday. And so give them a chance, right?
You're not a commencement speaker kind of guy, generally.
Well, I guess I am now.
Well,
not
is this
only
the
did
first
I
one?
Do the speech, it became a book. Yeah, and not one. And it
it's
was
a bookette,
really successful.
By the way. I don't know if you know that. It's a bookette.
A book
Isn't that what you call it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's more than a greeting card, less than a memoir. I was amazed that once I gave this speech and it really went viral, it got a huge amount. No one ever asked me to do another one. I thought I could branch out in that racket.
What year was it?
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow, there's still ample opportunity.
I know.
So when you get asked to do a commencement speech, you know, you're an unusual commencement speaker, as Jim just said. Do you go up and, you know, look at what Steve Jobs said at Stanford 10 years ago, what David Foster was, or do you just kind of wing it?
David Foster. I looked at one to see how long they were,
yeah.
to be
Wallace,
honest.
About the
yeah.
water, all yeah, yeah. floating in the water.
And his was good, though, I thought.
I loved it.
But most of them are just this Hallmark greeting card kind of, you know, vague. And, you know, so I thought if I'm supposed to inspire them, so I'm going to say, how did I get here? I got thrown out of every school I ever went to. I'd never seen a graduation except in prison where I taught. And I was the speaker in a prison graduation.
It
was pretty good because while we were eating, they had a barbecue and the person's father I was with, he was a murderer, one of my good students.
Oh.
And the father said, you finished? And he said, eating or killing people? And I always remember that. I'm like, God, you know, it's a reality sandwich, like real little things that happen in your life.
So you mentioned in your commencement speech that early on you were one of the initial marijuana busts.
The first one ever at NYU. Well, they threw me out of the dorm. Nothing. I just smoked pot and gave it to everybody.
Oh, okay.
And, but it was in 66, and you know, and took acid. That wasn't even illegal till 67. So, and they should have thrown me out, actually, because I didn't go to school. I just went to 42nd Street to watch movies. Like Olga's House of Shame. And they wanted us to watch the Odessa Step sequence from Potemkin. So
I thought you made Olga's House of Shame. Was
no,
I wrong about that?
No, but it's actually a good movie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's an early sexploitation movie. Yeah.
So, John, it's very hard to sum up. People should read this. They really should read this bookette, as you call
doesn't
it.
Doesn't take long.
It does not.
You don't even have to steal it.
Can you describe what your advice for these young budding adults was?
It is to not fear rejection because a no is free. And in show business is a life of rejection. In the arts, you got to keep asking. It's like Hitchhiking, which was my last book. You only need one person to say yes. Get in. And that's all you need. Someone has to like what you do. But you might be a great painter, but then what do? You got to figure out how to get it out in the world. So you have to learn the business part of whatever you're trying to get into at the same time, I think.
Have you dealt with a lot of rejection professionally?
Certainly. Oh, my God. I didn't get a good review for the first 10 years of my life.
Did that matter to you?
I built a career on negative reviews.
You did, actually.
Yeah, but you can't do that today because it's already been done. And the critics are too smart to do that, to give you that now. The one used to say to me in Baltimore, how you beat us to the typewriter by calling your films trash epics. And I did.
Yeah.
Talking to John Waters, whose newest book or booklet or bookette or whatever it is called Make Trouble.
John Waters, do you really get up at 6 o'clock in the morning every day to do
Monday
your work?
To Friday.
Monday
I
to
do,
Friday, yeah. And how long do you keep at it?
Oh, to writing, usually 11:30, 12. And then I have the meeting with everybody that works for me in the afternoon. We sell it. I think it up in the morning and sell it in the afternoon.
Because it's easier, your brain is clear in the morning. It's easier to think in the morning.
Yeah, I get dumber as the day goes
on.
But it doesn't matter. Some people only can write in the middle of the night. It doesn't matter as long as you keep your own hours.
We actually asked for you at 7 a.m., but they said the best we could do was at 1:05.
I did. a phone junket starting at 6 a.m. yesterday morning. So I just was on the train getting here, though. They just couldn't get me to Boston because I had a big signing last night in New York.
So trigger warnings are not your cup of tea. Why? I'm with you, by the way. I'm not sure for the same reason.
Well,
why do you
to
not
me,
like them?
You're supposed to, you know, have a safe place where your values are never questioned. I thought that's why you went to college.
Amen.
You know, and to me, I have nostalgia for rioting at colleges, but I thought in Berkeley he should speak, even though that guy Milo to me is not dangerous.
Guy, yeah.
He's the boys in the band. I met Breitbart, and I did Bill Marshall
Andrew,
with him. Yeah, he was
we
before
met
he
him
died.
At a bar.
He was all right. He said to me, I do the same thing you do. We're just on different sides. Mm-hmm. We're both provocateurs. He said, I learned everything from Abbie Hoffman. I just switched sides.
Can I tell you something? It's funny you say that. I've said this to Marjorie before. I think I said it a few weeks ago. We met him, well, I was going to say before he died. I think that's fairly
Very
obvious.
Shortly before he died.
I thought that he was a calculated provocateur, meaning I wasn't convinced he actually believed in what he did. Did you come away
with
that?
Well, he did start a left wing. He told me in the beginning I was on that side and I switched sides. And both sides, I mean, this year at the inauguration, there was this group that I kind of love reading about called Disrupt J20 that infiltrated the inaugural ball and they were going to throw acid. I thought they meant LSD, but they meant real acid, which seemed a little severe to me until I saw the musical groups that Trump had picked. But at the same time, then they were infiltrated by a Breitbart group and it was like spy versus spy. It was the radical right and the radical left. So it's exciting now, you know. So they're in spying on each other and everything.
Did you see the great group, the three dads from wherever the hell they were, like Utah or something the day before?
Was Pelican 212, which I can barely say that out loud. I mean, there is an impeachable fence. Music taste.
Yeah, it was
This was the honkiest group. And they dared to do James Brown cover songs for Trump dancing. I thought, what could African-Americans think when they're watching this?
I think he had a tough time recruiting the bands. You know?
Well, that's what I mean. Couldn't Levi Johnson
really
come out and show
tough.
His penis? He always said he was going to. And Kellyanne could have sang the Star Spangled Banner in Pig Latin. It could have been.
That would have been a lot better.
Who said no? Kevin Federline?
Yeah, we were talking earlier with our listeners about Trump's press secretary making the unfortunate remark about there was no gassing of people.
But don't you almost feel sorry for him?
Yes.
Oh, I do feel
I
sorry for him.
Because he will eventually quit, and he is eternally a buffoon, you know. And I can't ever look at him without thinking of the Saturday Night Live.
Oh, Melissa McCarthy,
and so I almost feel sorry because he has to go out and stick up for no matter what lunacy Trump says. He has to go out there and face all the people that hate him. So I almost feel bad for him.
We're talking with John Waters. The new book is Make Trouble. So you are not a fan, as you said, of reality TV. But Jim Browdy comes in here every Monday morning rhapsodizing about this great new TV thing he's seen. Either if it's
little miniseries.
Are you now turned on with the new Honey Boo Boo's Mother?
No, I've not. I watched the original Honey Boo Boo.
I never saw it.
Can I tell you something? This is true. This is not just created for you. I'd say one out of four times that I come in from a weekend of binge viewing of what I consider to be fabulous TV, I actually say to her that you should be doing this.
No, I'm Why really against reality TV.
No, not reality TV. I'm talking about. Oh, I'm not talking. I know you don't like reality. I'm talking
because
about
that makes you feel superior to the people.
I know that. I'm talking about scripted TV.
Oh, are you kidding? I just did a whole development deal. I've had three development deals. One with HBO for the sequel to Hairspray. It didn't get made, but they paid me well. Mm-hmm. No, I've done a lot. I'd be in TV in a minute. I've done a Hairspray TV show. I wrote the Bible for it and everything. So I'm not against TV. Mm-hmm. I'd do it in a minute.
Do you watch
TV? He's better. Well, I was just on Feud. I played William
Castle. I know that.
So, yeah, I watched some. I mean, not much because it's so hard to turn on a TV.
What does that mean? You mean to understand how to turn on a TV?
How many remotes do I have to know? And to change it, and I start crying.
That's why I need the young people.
So
that's why your own advice, right?
I know, but even young people can't figure it out. And I got new TV stuff in my house. It costs $20,000 so I can turn my TV off. It seems really, they're doing it today. And really, just so I can turn it on.
You know, speaking of current events, John Waters, we assume you have an opinion on the Dr. Dow episode on United Airlines. I assume you've seen the video 3,000 times.
Yeah, I have. And he's got a big, fat lawsuit.
You think so?
Coming. Yeah. He should be happy that gut showed. He'll get $1 million extra just for that.
Yeah. Can you explain
any
of it?
And he was a doctor. Sure, because they do – what they should have done is just keep offering more money, and then someone will go for it to get off the plane. If they ask me, I'm usually on my way to do a show, and I would lose the entire fee if I didn't show up that night. And they would have had to drag me off, too. Mm-hmm. But you know what flight attendants independents do now, and I read this in the New York Post, they'll get back at it because if they hate you, you know, you can't hear a fart on an airplane.
I wasn't aware of that.
I did not know that.
They know.
How do you know that?
Let me tell you, because flight attendants will tell you this is true. If they hate you, they go during the flight and bend over to wait on the person across the aisle, and they fart. And
really?
It's called crop dusting. So I'm telling you, really, don't. You really, that guy's going to get crop dusted.
By the way, that's even worse than getting dragged off the plane, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you don't know it, really, but I don't know. I think.
Now, do you deal with any corporate types like Oscar Munoz, for example, the man who decided that they had just reaccommodated Mr. Dow? And I mean, do you deal with any big boys and girls like that, or
no? Well, in the movie business, I certainly do.
I know,
do.
And you are know, they as clueless as Munoz
no,
is?
No, they aren't. Hollywood, they've been fair to me. The more money they give you, the more they're going to have to say. It's just algebra. Really, if you want to do anything you want, make an independent movie for no money.
So you've said too that you're not a big fan of reality TV, but you do like kind of the lowbrow stuff. So what's on?
I don't like what I like highbrow stuff.
You like highbrow
what?
Stuff.
Yeah.
Okay,
I, my top 10 list. I pick an art form every year is obscure French feel bad movies.
Really?
I mean, what bad movie? What would you say is a trashy movie I liked recently? Well, I certainly like Piranha 3DD, but that was a long time ago. I liked Raw, the new Cannibal movie is pretty good, but that's an art movie, I think.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't even know all these movies that cost $100 million and make $100
What's
billion.
What's the most of the
movies? I don't even know what they are. I go now to the theaters and then you have to sit there and they say, they punish you for being on time. Then we have to watch on-show entertainment in the beginning. When a director wants to start a movie, does he say cut, go, or go, baby, go. Makes me insane. I have to sit there and listen to that.
Oh, what's the largest choice budget? Questions you
I
mean? I know.
Hate them.
What's the largest budget you ever worked with? And what
13
movie
million,
it?
Serial Mom, which is my best movie.
That's pretty serious money, though, isn't it?
Is it? It was then. 13 million then would be 20 million today, probably. Yeah.
We're talking to John Waters.
How about Moonlighting
book,
that won the Oscar this year?
Oh, I'm glad he won. You know, I'm glad he won.
That was so different.
I actually think that Get Out says more about black-white relationships than any movie that's been made in a long, long time.
I know,
I've got to
go
movie.
See that. You've
yeah, but you don't
it.
Think
it's
that.
Really, I said the wrong movie.
We talked about this.
Moonlighting.
I don't want to give it away. But
I like it because the villains are white liberals.
Yeah, but I was going to say, they're so stereotyped, don't you think, to the point of absurdity?
The villain in movies about race are always white crackers. They're not liberals.
Yeah, well, that's actually a good point.
But
that
I do, but
point.
I do love that part, even though I haven't seen the movie, because there is, you see a lot of that, you know, that we're always criticizing
says,
in the suburbs.
He says, I'd vote for Obama the third time when he meets it. Oh, it was hilarious. It's really a smart movie, I think.
Yeah. So. No, I think of that all the time, because you think of people that live like in you know, the Tony suburbs of Boston, you know, always criticizing what goes on in Boston. I mean, the classic case in Boston was busing, which was a terrible time. But the biggest critics were the people that lived in Wellesley, and they weren't going to have to worry about any busing situations. They were very holier than thou out there Wellesley about all the people that actually get bused. That always drove me insane.
Yeah. You know, your Baltimore accent is intense. You know, it's really.
Is
I'm
it?
A Philly boy.
Oh, God, I'm so. Well, they.
I knew it was
going to
hurt your feelings, but I'm a Philly boy, and I only people from Philly can detect Coca-Cola, and that's.
But well, Philly and Baltimore are pretty close.
Oh, I know they're really close, really but close, you've got it like big time kind of thing. Don't
God,
you?
Now I'm going to kill.
I
myself.
Didn't mean to offend you, but. I mean, you do, don't you?
I guess. You just told me that. So,
are you doing any hitchhiking these days anymore?
No, I wrote a book about it.
I know you
have to do it again.
About it.
I did it once accidentally in San Francisco recently. I went to a book signing of another author I really like, Rachel Cusk. And I had this woman, I didn't know where I was. It was really far away. And this woman said, do you want to ride? And I said, yeah, that was sort of hitchhiking. That was the closest
Rachel,
I got to.
T-U-S-K?
C-U-S-K.
C-U-S-K, okay.
Yeah, she's a novelist I really like. English novels.
Oh, okay.
So what are you working on these days, John Waters?
I'm working on a book called Mr. Know-It-All, which is not a booklet. It's a real book. And I'm working on that. I've been working on that for about 2 years. And that's the main thing. And then I do the John Waters. I have a spoken word show called This Filthy World. I even play at horror conventions. I just was with Kreskin last weekend.
Kreskin
the amazing
is alive?
Kreskin. Yes, and he read my mind. I love Kreskin. I don't care. I'm not impressed by many celebrities. Kreskin. And Eminem are the only two I want
what
to
is Kreskin? I mean, I think I saw Kreskin on Johnny Carson maybe 40 years ago.
He told me he still works 350 out of 365 nights a year. He's more than James Brown, the hardest working manager.
More than James Brown.
And then he told me a funny story. He said he was on a plane. I'm sure he's told the story a million times. And it was horrible turbulence. Everybody was frightened. So he went to the bathroom and came back, and everybody was quiet because they figured, well, if it's going to crash, he'll know. So.
Oh, I love that. So when you go to the Coolidge Corner, what are you going to do? The theater? What are you going to do?
I'm doing a book signing, and I'm getting interviewed on stage. And, you know, we're going to meet all my fans are so great. They get dressed for me. They come there all ages. I had people last night in New York that were 15. They weren't even born when I made my last movie.
How much do you love that?
I love it because the only thing you can't buy. Advertising cannot buy you young fans.
You know, speaking of dressed, I mentioned to Marjorie, I was in Provincetown in August, and this guy rides by on his bicycle. And by the way, to stand out in Provincetown is pretty difficult. Would you agree? Yeah.
Well, depends. I mean,
and you, it's like John Waters and everybody else. Is that a fair statement?
I don't know. I've been there. It's my 52nd summer there.
Is that really true?
Yeah. So I used to run the bookshop there. So I have a. When I was a young man, when I was 20, I worked in the Provincetown bookshop every summer.
I did not know this. Cross paths. You ran the leather shop, Jim.
You know, I had a leather store on. You know, little red firehouse. Oh, you lost the sound.
Yeah,
little red firehouse.
I can hear you. I'm right across
from what used to be the Chrysler Art Museum. It used to be a head shop and record store.
Yeah.
Did you ever shop in there?
Yeah. Shoplifted, probably.
You probably did, actually. I remember you now. I knew you.
I never got caught.
John Waters, it's great to see you again.
We were speaking with the filmmaker, writer, and director John Waters about his latest book, Make Trouble. Coming up, it's another author interview with someone who has made trouble in her own way to great effect. That's Lindy West. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today we're on tape replaying some of our favorite discussions, which included the one we had earlier this year with writer Lindy West on her memoir, Shrill. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. In her memoir, Shrill, a collection of connected essays, Lindy West uses personal experiences to get universal truths on everything from fat acceptance to feminism. She does it with humor, empathy, and an occasional F-bomb. West is a columnist for The Guardian, a culture writer for GQ, founder and editor of I Believe You, It's Not Your Fault, an advice blog for teens. Lindy, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Lindy, I've been schooled. I'm not going to say overweight, heavy, none of those things.
Big.
I'm going to say fat, and I'm going to ask you what you think, and you write a lot about this, obviously, what is the non-fat or even the fat person's view of people who are fat?
Well, I think we're all raised in the same culture. So I think fat people are raised to sort of fear and disdain other fat people the same as thin people are. And that's sort of what most of the book is about, is me figuring out how to not be uncomfortable with my own body and other people's fat bodies. But I don't know. It's very strange to live feeling so disconnected from your body. And we don't think of fat people as fat. We think of them as thin people who are failures. And so I spent most of my life, the scariest thing I could imagine was, what if I'm fat forever? Like, I couldn't even imagine the question in my mind because it was so terrifying. And the sort of key to making my life come alive was confronting that fact, or that probability, because most fat people stay fat.
Go ahead.
Now I lost my...
Well, here's the thing which really so resonates. The difference between the perception of fat women and fat men.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think fat men definitely experience discrimination and trauma, and I hear from fat men a lot who also don't feel particularly represented in the fat positive movement, because it's very woman driven. But we have other metrics of value for men, and for women it's really pretty much just aesthetics. It's and body size is a huge part of that. There's just one kind of body that you're allowed to have, you know, if you want to be a valuable human being as a woman.
You know, so, I agree with this, by the way. As a kid who was fat, we've had this discussion on the show only 1,000 times, but not with you, but I'll get to that in a second. But fat shaming is also done, it meant, even though less so, the cover of The New Yorker with Donald Trump's big behind hitting a golf ball, I think, on the White House lawn.
Much different
was an effort. No, I
than
agree.
Hillary Clinton's big behind.
I totally agree. But can I get to the term, your notion that you prefer the term? When I was a kid, Marjorie's heard this too. My mother used to take me to the portly department at Jacob Reed's, which was a clothing store in Philly. I was humiliated. I was humiliated by having to go to the portly department. I was humiliated that they called it the portly department. But then on the flip side, I was also humiliated when anyone called me fat. And I would never, ever have thought of referring myself as fat. So how did you get to the place where that's, you don't want euphemisms, you don't want to, how did you get there?
Well, the problem is the term, or is the stigma, not the term itself. Mm-hmm. You know, fat can be totally neutral. It's just a descriptor. It's an accurate descriptor for my body size. So I guess, you know, it's pretty common in any kind of, you know, social justice movement or in activist circles to reclaim terms that have been used to hurt you. You know, if I call myself fat and declare that, you know, I am fat and I'm not ashamed and there's nothing wrong with me, it takes some of the power out of other people calling me fat. So, I mean, that was really kind of the first step in this whole process was becoming comfortable with the term. And there is something, and if other people want to use euphemisms, other people prefer big or curvy or whatever, that's fine. To me, euphemisms feel a little bit insulting, or not insulting, but they just remind me that the person I'm talking to is uncomfortable with my body.
Did I read in your book, was it with your college roommate, the perfect college roommate? Everybody's got the perfect college roommate, by the way. All of us imperfect people. Was that where you first sort of started buying into the terminology? Isn't that what you wrote? No? When was it?
It was years after that.
Oh, it was.
That was the first time I talked about it, but I still talked about it in this context of shame and, you know, sort of self hatred. I was probably 26 or so, 26, 27 even. Pretty old. I mean, I was like, well, I mean, for a
in
person,
the grand scheme of things,
in the grand scheme of, you know, starting to feel like you're in control of your own life and like you believe that you deserve happiness. Yeah. I mean, that's a long time to wait. So, but yeah, I just, it was the internet, you know, I started being exposed to, really powerful, assertive, confident, fat voices on the internet, and especially looking at pictures of fat people on the internet, you can really, really rewire your brain to not feel this thrill of discomfort when you see fat bodies. If you just look at fat bodies,
that's Lindy, you know, West. Her latest, her book is Shrill.
I don't want to get ahead of myself, but that is a great point.
Which
that seeing people that are, my inclination is to say heavy, but I'm not going to say, I'm going to say fat, is so unusual. Women, particularly in the media. I mean, the whole Lena Dunham, she's not even fat. She's just a little bit chubby. Mm-hmm. The whole naked Lena Dunham thing. Oh, my God. Talk about that. She's the star of Girls. That was like a revolution or something.
I mean, it really is. You know, I think the way that she uses her body on that show is absolutely, it's very, very powerful. And I don't know that she gets enough credit for that. She's still one of the only people doing that. I don't see naked, non-conforming bodies on television anywhere else, really, you know? It's very, very rare because we punish people, you know? We punish people who show bodies that are not supposed to be seen, you know?
But the thing is, you saw her and you thought, you know, she looks pretty good. I mean,
she just looks like a person.
Yeah, I mean,
she looks
she
like
does.
All the people that you know and the people that you're likely going to see naked in your life, they don't look like movie stars. You know what I mean? That's what's so weird about this disconnect. She just has a normal body, like an average body that a person has.
Yeah, but I don't want this conversation to become one how far we have gone. I am embarrassed to say I listen to sports radio from time to time. If you were to ask me what is the number one most regular topic of ridicule, it's Lena Dunham. I mean, it is disgusting, by the way. It is nonstop. But when you have nothing else to do, you talk about Lena Dunham. Do you really want to see her naked body on television?
Yeah, of course men want to see her. Are you kidding me? Who are men? Who do men think they're having sex with? They're having sex with people who look like Lena Dunham. It's such a lie.
Yeah, and, you know, then you look at the men themselves that are complaining about this, and you think,
well, that was
you
your point before.
Really? Yeah. One hell of a nerve.
Hey, absolutely. You know, Lindy, the term punching, you mentioned credit before vis-a-vis Lena Dunham. Did you create the term punching up, or you just elevated it to an art form? I mean, which you did.
I tried to dig up the origin of it. Someone told me that it was Chris Rock who came up with mm-hmm. that term. I couldn't find it.
Nor could I. I was looking this weekend.
Yeah, but it wasn't me.
I thought it was. Well, but you use it in the context of the rape joke thing, which obviously you became pretty famous for long before Shrill. Was it Jezebel
where
you wrote that?
Yeah.
Tell people, if you would, how that whole thing evolved, what that was about.
Oh, yeah. So I was working at Jezebel, which is a feminist blog. And
it's a great website. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, I was working there. I had come from, sort of a comedy, not exactly a comedy background. I was not a comedian, although I sometimes did comedy. Comedy was kind of my thing. You know, my husband is a comedian. I spend all my time with comedians. And I was a lifelong comedy obsessive, which I don't know if was that common in sort of feminist blogging circles. So this thing happened with Daniel Tosh, who's a comedian, who had made a rape joke at a show, and a woman wrote a blog post about it, and it was everyone was talking about it, and I thought, oh, I am perfectly placed to comment on this. Maybe I can bridge this gap between feminists and comedians, which is how it's framed, as though they're mutually exclusive, which is irritating. But so my only point was that I tried to make in this essay that, you can talk about whatever you want in your act. But a couple of things, one, you're not free from criticism. Talk about whatever you want, but we're going to talk back to you. And also, you get to make choices just as a human being. What do you want to put out in the world? Statistically speaking, you're going to have rape victims in your audience, and you might have a rapist in your audience. And I just want people to I don't think it's an unreasonable for people to think to themselves, who do I want to leave my show feeling validated? Do I want rapists to feel great? if you're gonna use these horrific traumas to get a laugh, if you want to be considered a good person, you just owe it to yourself to put some thought into it.
So how did it go, that attempt to bridge the gap between feminists and comedians? Not so well, right?
Not so well at the time. I spent several years being just berated on Twitter, mostly variations on, why do you care about rape? You're so fat, no one would ever want to rape you. A million versions of that. But it ultimately was really a win, because my point was that comedy might have a small misogyny problem. And then the response to prove me wrong was just literally years of male comedians and comedy fans screaming horrible misogyny at me.
But wait a second. I thought the other reason it was a success is your first paragraph of your obituary, maybe decades from now, is going to be the only person in American history to have a troll apologize to them on live radio or something. Explain what this guy did about your dead father. I mean, talk about, I'm making the right connection, right? That was the guy.
Although I only thought it was about rape jokes. It was actually about being fat.
Oh, okay.
So, another one of the.
But you mentioned it was during your rape summer or whatever you called
it. Yeah. So in the middle of all this rape joke brouhaha, a guy made a Twitter account pretending to be my father, who had died a year and a half earlier. Got his picture, put the bio said, embarrassed father of an idiot, and the location said dirt hole in Seattle, and then he was just sending me rude tweets like everyone does all day every day. I wrote an essay about it for Jezebel, saying it is totally unreasonable that women have to deal with this as part of our jobs. And the guy read the essay, because trolls are obsessed with you. That's their thing. And recognized himself in it, obviously, and then sent me an email and apologized.
And then apologized, you know, on radio, yeah, national radio or something, right?
Yeah, and then I interviewed him on the radio.
You know, I did not realize until I read your stuff that rape jokes were standard fare in a lot of young comedians, and that it Tosh is the one that made the joke about gang raping the woman in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just don't get why anybody thinks that's funny. And if you're talking about Holocaust jokes, it all depends. If you're making fun of the Nazis, but you don't want to be making fun of the tortured people in the concentration camps. So they kind of miss the whole thing there.
Right. That's the idea of punching up versus punching
exactly.
down. Exactly. Which is, you know,
exactly.
you just always, everywhere in life, not just in comedy, but you should live your life aware of hierarchies of power. You know, who has power and who doesn't, and who deserves to be... taken down, and who needs to be buoyed up, you know?
We're talking to Lindy West. The book is Shrill. You have a whole section here about something that Jim and I have talked a lot about, which is getting on an airplane when you're fat. You say in this piece, nobody wants to sit next to a fat person on an airplane, and don't think we don't know. And you talk about how you have to plot out in advance, you know, the size of the seats on different airlines of where you're going to sit and stuff. So tell us about this.
Yeah. Should I read?
Oh, if you read a little piece, it'd be great.
All
yeah.
right.
This was prearranged. I want you to know. Don't think this is... but go ahead. She's going to read a little piece from... What's the name of this? I Don't Fit? Or
The Day I Didn't Fit.
The Day I Didn't Fit. Okay. Lindy West.
All right. So this is, for context, this is a chapter where I talk about the first time I sat down in a plane seat and was like, ooh, this is uncomfortable for me, which is weird that there's a threshold. It was literally like I took a trip to Texas for a couple days. I guess I ate too much barbecue. I don't know, because on the way back, I was like, wow, this is tight. All right.
Here we go.
If you've never tried cramming your hips into an angular metal box that's an inch or two narrower than your flesh under the watchful eye of resentful tourists, and then sitting motionless in there for 5 hours while you fold your arms and shoulders up like a dying orchid in order to be as unobtrusive as possible, run, don't walk. It's like squeezing your bones in a vise. The pain makes your teeth ache. I once spent a tearful 8-hour flight from Oslo to Seattle, convinced I could feel my femurs splintering like candy canes. It hurts. Much worse than any physical pain is the anxiety, the dread, of walking up the aisle and not knowing what type of plane you're on. Every model has different seat widths and belt lengths, which also vary from airline to airline. Am I going to fit this time? Will I have to ask for an extender? Is this a 17-incher or an 18-incher? Is the person next to me going to hate me? Does everyone on this plane hate me? I paid money for this?
It's a great,
Lindy West,
it's a great essay. I also want to say, you have done something and talked about something that's been one of my crusades for years, that if every woman in America who had an abortion came out of the closet and said not an abortion, it would change the whole debate. It's similar to gay people in a way, because they would try not to be your mother, your sister, your next door neighbor, mm-hmm. your great aunt Maud. So tell us about that, having women talk about their own abortions, and also the piece you wrote about your own abortion, which was pretty fascinating.
Yeah, so in fall of 2015, which was right in the middle of writing the book, that's when the Planned Parenthood sells baby parts
videos
were happening. Yeah. And I was talking to a friend of mine named Amelia Bono about that, and about the potential defunding of Planned Parenthood, and how dismayed we were. And sort of came up in this conversation that both of us had abortions and that we'd never talked about it. And this is a close friend that I talk about personal things with. And we were like, neither of us were ashamed. We both came from, you know, progressive liberal families who wouldn't have batted an eye. You know, there was no reason for us to have been quiet about it. And it was this moment of realization that we had sort of caved to a stigma that we didn't believe in. And so, you know, and from there, looking outward, it's like, if we caved and we didn't feel comfortable talking about this, what do, you know, women... in conservative communities, women of faith, like there must be so many people suffering and feeling just absolutely alone and terrified. And so anyway, we started thinking about, what could we do? Could we do something? Could we organize a storytelling, abortion storytelling night? I don't know if anyone would go, but or a YouTube channel or something. And in the middle of this, Amelia just, she just wrote her abortion story on Facebook. And in a beautiful, in a really, it was a really beautiful piece of writing. You know, she said, my abortion made me happy in a totally unqualified way. Why would I not be happy that I was not forced to become a mother? And so I took a screen grab of it and put it on Twitter, where I had quite a few followers. And it really, it just immediately, so, and I added this hashtag, shout your abortion. So I, then we, I was just immediately inundated with other people's stories. And clearly there was this need there to talk. And because the fact is that abortion is very common.
Very common.
Very, very, very.
One in three?
One in three.
Yeah.
And it's, that means that people in every community are choosing abortion. Many, many people, I think a majority of people who have abortions are already mothers. It's, you know, the idea that this is some deviant, rare, traumatic thing is simply not true. It's not reflected by data. And the fact, and so what Amelia and I realized was that the fact that there is this taboo in place, that we don't talk about it, means that that it creates this vacuum that anti-abortion activists can fill with every horror story they can come up with. And I want to be clear that Shout Your Abortion was not compulsory. There are a lot of people who can't talk about it, don't want to talk about it. Everyone deserves medical privacy. You don't have to talk about it. But if you're in a position like mine where I have very little at stake, you know, I got some death threats on the internet, but those aren't really real. You know, I'm not going to be ostracized.
Just another death threat.
Well, you know, I'm not going to be ostracized by my family. I'm not going to lose my job. I'm, you know, it just seemed like the least I can do. And it's also very liberating to say, just, I mean, God, stand up for something as basic as getting to steer your own future and decide what grows in your body.
We're talking to Lindy
West.
Great
piece.
Hey, Lindy,
you.
Before you go, we're going to talk to our listeners in a few minutes about this. Have you seen the InStyle magazine cover with Amy Schumer in a bathing suit?
Yeah, I think I did see it. I didn't inspect it closely.
Well, you didn't have to inspect it closely, but Dana Dugan, who none of us ever heard of, is the owner of something called South Shore Swimwear, and she finds herself in a little bit of a mess. Schumer is a self-proclaimed, this is her speak, Dana speaking, cabbage patch kid. She fat shames herself in her comedy routine. That was her defense of the against the criticism. But here is what she said to the Boston Globe. What happened to the allure, the beauty, and mystique of high fashion magazines? With the new PC culture, anyone and everyone thinks they can be a CoverGirl swimsuit model. I don't think that's right. It may sound harsh, but in my opinion, being overweight is not healthy. It's not stylish. It is not attractive.
Yeah, who cares? Who cares what Dana? I mean, I don't know. All right, go make your own magazine.
But what do you say? But to someone, to a fat person listening to the show, and again, I have been many times in my life. You've gotten past this notion that your reason for being should be to get thin. I mean, what do you say to that person whose obsession, because it's foisted upon them, is you got to get thin? That's all you should worry about. What do you say to that?
I have a lot of empathy for people who are in that situation. You know, I believe that you only get one life. I don't think I get to do this again. And I just want to live my life, you know? I think we trap, especially women, in this position of just dumping all your time, all your money, all your energy into this one goal that if you talk to people who have lost tremendous amounts of weight, does not magically make you happy. That's just simply not how it works. And you can live... You can nourish your body with food and you can move your body because it feels good without this aesthetic goal at the end. You can take care of yourself because you care about yourself and not because you hate yourself. It's a much, much more constructive thing to do. And I think it has a higher success rate. You know, taking care of your... A thing I always say to people is you can't take good care of something that you hate.
Can I tell you something? Your healthy attitude is going to get you nowhere. That's pretty obvious. This is really unfortunate.
Lindy West is a columnist at The Guardian and contributor to This American Life. Her latest book is Shrill. Up next, it's Alex Bean for cameo appearance. The issue to explain the emoluments clause. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
So in any case, you know, ordinarily I'd lead into the explainer, but in light of the fact I love these moments, even though Marjorie is one of the smartest people I've ever met in my life, she cannot say the word that you're describing today.
Well, I'm getting
today.
Better. I keep wanting to call it emollient.
It's not emollient.
Well,
what is he explaining today?
Emollument. It's emollument.
Okay, so you're going to explain.
I've got it down now, Jim.
All we've heard about right after, since Donald Trump won, through the transition, through the first 5-6 days of his presidency, is whether or not he is violating the Emoluments Clause of the United States Constitution. And my understanding, Alex Beam, is your 45-second explainer today, you're going to attempt to explain that in clear English for people, yes?
I am going to super nail this. I can't guarantee 45 seconds, but this is genuinely interesting. And I'm ready to go.
Okay, start the clock. Give him 50 seconds.
No,
today.
No, I want a minute. 50.
No, we don't have time for this.
Oh,
50
get
seconds.
Here. Get out of here
for the explainer. Starting now. Go.
Okay. This is. I won't repeat how fascinating it is. The Emoluments Clause appears in Article 1 of the Constitution.
That's correct.
And it has a point. And the point is, it doesn't want government officials taking gifts or, in a sense, bribes. From any people of any other nations. It derives from when in the 18th century, when our infant republic sent ambassadors to the great courts of Europe. For instance, Benjamin Franklin was given a jewel-encrusted snuff box by the King of France. Mm-hmm. And Congress said, no, our people shouldn't be accepting gifts. I'm going to fast forward. For instance, we all know, and this relates to us, by the way, we all know that, say, like when Jackie Kennedy left the White House or whatever, the nation inherits all these gifts from the Shah of Iran, because you can give a gift to the President of the United States, but it has to eventually go back to the people of the United States. Okay, I'm not done.
Not only are you not done, you haven't started.
Because
all you've done,
that's
you've
important background.
Okay.
But you haven't explained what
that's
it is.
That's important background. And I'm going to link it up to me and Marjorie, because it touches when you go out to lunch with a government official, eight times out of ten, they said, look, I'm sorry, but I can't, you know, I can't even pay half.
You still haven't explained what it does.
Because you can't give any kind of gift, but I'm getting there. Okay, Trump, okay, fine, but it's utterly fascinating because it hasn't been adjudicated yet. So Trump obviously owns, let's bump
the hotel,
all,
the hotel, Trump International
Hotel. He owns lots of stuff.
And they are being rented by entities of foreign governments.
Correct.
In one case, a Chinese bank. In another case, a Saudi or Kuwaiti-owned da-da-da, or embassies have parties there. So the legal question is that an emolument?
Right.
If the Kuwaitis have a – get out of here. This is interesting. Have a $600,000 party at a Trump hotel.
Yes.
Is that a gift to Trump? And it's definitely –
even if he complies with his pledge to donate any profit – from his hotels and money from foreign governments to the United States Treasury,
but how exactly
the receipt alone.
Are we to determine if the profits and what he's donating,
well,
all this kind of stuff, because we don't know about his taxes?
But
what
why,
an interesting thing about the emoluments.
No, this is a legal issue. It is not a fact. It's not about the facts of whether or not he's getting this money. There is no question his businesses are receiving money from foreign governments.
Marjorie's point, you don't have to. Her point is perfectly valid, because he says about profits,
exactly.
And we never know what's a revenue.
The trust issue.
Yeah.
Do you believe him?
There's a really interesting legal question: is a fee for service, is that an emolument? I mean, if I pay the taxi guy to drive me a couple miles, okay, have I given him a gift? Not really. I've given him a reward for service. And then lastly, there's a question about whether this standing is utterly fascinating, because a citizens group has sued Trump,
including Larry Tribe right across the river.
Yeah, well, is Larry Tribe injured? That's the question. Does he have standing to sue?
Okay, fine. It was like a 9-minute explainer.
I know, but
it was very important. Alex Beam joins us every week. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe. His latest book is The Feud, Vladimir Nabokov, Edmund Wilson, and the End of a Beautiful Friendship. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Boston Public Radio. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Jason Tureski, Tori Bedford, Molly Boygon, and our engineer, John the Claw Parker.